Okay, guys, if you'll take a seat, we want to get started. We have a really long agenda tonight. Keeping that in mind, I'm going to say this to everybody, including division employees.
You.
Short, sweet, to the point. You're an individual, and you're asking a question or making a comment. You have 3 minutes, and Ben is on it. He's got his timer. Don't mess with him. And then if you're an organization, you have 5. But keep that in mind. We just have an extremely long agenda, and we want to move through things efficiently. All right. So we will start with the approval of the agenda. Correct?
Motion to approve.
Okay, we have a motion. Anybody second that? Okay, so we have a motion by Kent Johnson, seconded by Kirk Player to approve. Everybody in favor? Opposed? Unanimous. Is that good? All right. I'm new to this job, so you guys have to be patient. Second on the agenda, approval of minutes from our last meeting. A motion?
I didn't see anything out of order. Motion to approve.
Okay. Kent?
Motion to approve.
Okay. So we have a motion by Kent Johnson. Do you want to second it, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll second it.
Seconded by Jeff Christensen. All in favor? All opposed? So unanimous. I don't know what this means. Old business. Is he talking about me and specifically, or? Ben and we're both looking at each other while Chris is frolicking in New York City. Right. Okay. Oh, is okay. Okay, so Wildlife Board meeting. So, Kent, do you want to present on this? So this is information from the, is this the August Wildlife Board?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was on August 31st, Wildlife Board. I think in the interest of time, we can just do the stuff that was pertinent to the Southeast region, if that's
okay.
Sounds great. Most of the stuff was passed over the Wildlife Board. One of them was a 4-3 on the fur bearer rule amendments. Everything else passed unanimous. The one thing that would interest the Southeast RAC the most was the cougar recommendations and the both Manti units were changed to a split between a harvest objective and limited entry. And permits were moved to the South Manti as recommended by the Southeast RAC, and that was approved unanimously by the Wildlife Board. Everything else that was on the Wildlife Board, the beaver rules and things, everything was, and the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations were all approved as unanimously as submitted by the division. And that's basic, an overview as quick as I can do it. Is that good enough, Trish?
Yeah, that sounds good.
One thing I might add to that, though, is sometimes I've been guilty of this myself. We think that maybe the RAC process doesn't really work and that the Wildlife Board just kind of does what they want to do anyway. But through the process and actually going to a Wildlife Board meeting, I was able to see that they do give a lot of weight and consideration to the recommendations that come out of the various RACs. And it's kind of important to have the process, and we appreciate the input that everybody gives because it does help and it does have an impact on the decisions that are made.
Great comment.
Okay, and then also there was a Wildlife Board meeting in September, and most of that board had to do with a lot of what we're going over tonight, actually, and a lot of action logs were asked to be given, and so with additional dates, and everything was motioned and passed. So we should be hearing some of this stuff through tonight's RAC.
Okay, next on the agenda, we have the regional update. Are you doing that, Ben? Oh, great.
All right, as mentioned before, my name's Lieutenant Ben Wolford, and I am in place of Chris. He wanted to be in New York going to some shows and stuff, so I've been asked to help spear this tonight, just to go through some of the things happening in the region. Our aquatics, we just finished our fall gill netting at Schofield, Electric Lake, and Joes Valley. Numbers looked pretty good, they were saying. We also did some electrofishing on the Huntington Creek. We reached our goal for the round-tailed chubs at our Orangeville pond. We had a number of 50 that we wanted, and we have gotten that. And then also we are doing a bunch of sampling at our hatcheries. Most of these are happening in the central region, but we're checking for any mud snails or any quagga mussel that may have infiltrated the hatcheries there. Next one's habitat. On the 28th, we actually have a volunteer day over at the Matheson Wetland Preserve. Should be a fun day if you can come out. Please. Is that supposed to be September? Okay. It says November. I'm just reading what the slide says. So, okay. Also, bush hogging at Grimes Wash. Done some of that. And then we're also doing some dredging on the pond. I believe it's the central pond over at the Matheson Preserve. Law enforcement, we just finished a busy hunt. We're working over 20 cases right now. A lot of these cases will probably have some revocations coming with it. We've just completed an investigation on the Carbon County buck that was killed. Maybe you probably heard that was a very high-profile deer there in Carbon County. Right now we're still trying to get our heads above water, and we're working the remaining of these hunts throughout the season. We are also doing a beard permit program, so you may see some of us actually with some beards out there when normally we can't. But we pay $25 to be able to get this permit, and then we use that money to buy coats for some underprivileged kids throughout the state. So it's a pretty cool thing. And then our AIS season on the interdiction side is finally coming to a halt over at Bullfrog. We are getting many boats are coming out with mussels attached, but we're dealing with those on a case-by-case scenario. On the outreach section, we had a waterfowl hunting clinic on the 23rd of September. Had some good participation there. We also had fly fishing on September 30th. On October 9th, we did a kokanee salmon viewing day up at Electric Lake, and then this Saturday down at Nashwash we're doing a mule deer watch, and I do know that most of those deer started to move down, and so it's a cool thing to go see those things. On the wildlife side, October 14th and 16th we had a very successful youth pheasant hunt. Maine kids came out there, they were able to kill some birds. The deer hunt was, like I said before, it's completed. We have some good feedback from some hunters. They're doing their deer classifications pretty soon here. Right now, the wildlife section has been pretty busy with the bighorn sheep surveys. And then in January, we're looking at doing some transplants for some bighorns in January. So more information to come on those. And that's all we have from right now. Any questions?
I have a question. You say you had some good feedback from the hunters this year. Is that like statewide or region specific?
I'm just reading what's on there.
So you really didn't want any questions.
We have heard some good things about it from the law enforcement side, being talking with the hunters. Of course, those that harvested said it was a great hunt, those that didn't said it wasn't a great hunt. So, but I think that's overall throughout the state. Am I right? Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thanks.
You did a good job, Ben. Okay, next on the agenda, we have waterfowl recommendations from Blair.
All right, so tonight I'll be presenting the 2018-2019 waterfowl hunting recommendations. I wanted to give you just a brief habitat update real quick as far as the major breeding areas in North America. This last year in 2017, we had a lot better water year than we have in 2016. The majority of our birds come from the Alberta area. You can see it's that big green blob right there. And so what that means is that a lot of birds were raised this year and they'll be coming south. So it's really good news for our hunters as well as our duck populations. Looking at our North American duck population, really the last couple of years we've been hovering right around 50 million birds, which is the highest we've had really on record. This year was a little bit down from where we were last year, but overall still great numbers of ducks out there. If you look at them in a species-by-species basis, for the most part, everything went down just a tiny bit. But our long-term averages for ducks across North America is great. Really, the only two we're concerned about is the pintail and the scaup, and those have been below their long-term average for quite some time now. And so we do have concerns with them, but everything else is doing great and well above the long-term average. Our swan and goose populations continue to thrive as well. Our tundra swans, which come from Alaska, have been continue to slowly increase, as well as our Canada geese and our light goose populations. And we've seen great increases in those, and they continue to slowly increase year to year. The way we calculate our duck season is based on our population of mallards all across the western part of North America. Given the habitat conditions and the population we had last year, we saw another really robust mallard year. And so because of that, we'll have a 107-day season and a 7-bird bag offered to us, and so that'll be our recommendation. We also have 3 species that have species-specific harvest strategies. Those are pintails, canvasback, and scaup. So look at those 3 individually. For the most part, they're doing well enough to have pretty liberal packages. And so for pintails and canvasback, we'll have the 107-day season with a bag of 2. And for scaup, we have the moderate package, which is an 86-day season and a bag of 3. The way our seasons will shake out, the northern zone will start in the first weekend of October, and the southern zone will start in the second weekend of October. For our scaup seasons, we structure those for the northern zone to start in the first part of October, and the southern zone, we start essentially the end of the season and go back 86 days. We see most of our scaup in the southern part of the state towards the end of the season, so that's the justification for that. As far as other bag limits and possessions are concerned, pintails are the only species that will be changing next year, and that will be going up to 2, which is great for our hunters here in the state. For our dark goose zones, we're not recommending any changes for season dates or zones or bag limits or possession. For light geese, we're not recommending any other changes other than one small change in Millard County. We want to hunt geese a little bit longer in that county just to address some depredation concerns. The other challenge we have there is we need to close the season for a period of time before the Snow Goose Festival occurs in Delta. And so we're going to make that closure a little bit shorter, but we should have plenty of geese around still for that festival, as well as be able to target geese a little bit more through hunting pressure. For our swan season, we're not recommending any changes there. And for our youth season dates, we're not recommending any changes here at all. The thing we do want to remind people is that you do have to have a mentor with you if you participate in this hunt. And so those participating can be 17 or younger on July 31st, but they do have to have a mentor even if they're 16 or older. If they're 16-year-old and older, they also need to have a duck stamp as well while they're participating in this hunt. The other change we're making outside of waterfowl is to sandtail cranes. We've been working with Uinta County for a couple of years to try to address a lot of depredation issues they have there. And we've been working with the Fish and Wildlife Service to extend the season date so we can hunt the cranes longer in that area. We got approval to do that this year, and so we're recommending to have 20-day seasons there instead of 10-day seasons. And so we'll start our seasons on the last Saturday of September and run for 20 days and then begin the next season. This should allow us to distribute hunting pressure as well as to hunt for a little bit longer and try to reduce the damage these cranes are doing. The only real change we're making this year, we are redefining the motor vehicle definition in our waterfowl rule. So this will apply specific to our waterfowl management areas, and we're defining that as a vehicle that's self-propelled or possesses the ability to be self-propelled. We're also allowing exemptions for motorized wheelchairs as well as electronic bikes. And then we're just cleaning up a few things in that rule that need to be changed. And those are our recommendations. Thank you.
Okay, at this time, are there any questions from the RAC? Any questions from the audience? And at this point, let me just make sure that if you are going to have a comment tonight, make sure that you fill out a comment card and bring it up to Ben if you haven't already done so on any agenda item. And then just to make sure that we delineate a question from a comment. So if you come up during the question period, ask a question. If you're asking for clarification, but if it's a comment, please wait until that time. All right, RAC comments. What am I doing? Oh, public comments? Oh, sorry, audience comments. Do we have any for this? No? Okay. RAC comments. Okay. Do I have a motion?
I'll make a motion to accept the recommendations as presented.
Okay, so we have a motion by Eric Luke to accept the recommendations as presented, seconded by Kirk Player. All in favor? All opposed? Okay, unanimous in favor. Okay, so next we have a presentation by Kobe Jones on bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime. Is that right? Oh, sorry. You don't look like Kobe. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I missed.
I thought we were trying to
move. We were. I know. Yeah. We were moving.
Hey, so I'm Jessica Van Wert. I'm with the Utah Prairie Dog Management Biologist in the Southern Region. I'm here to propose the rule changes for regulations of Utah Prairie Dogs. Just to clarify, Utah Prairie Dogs are only found in southwestern Utah and only in the Southern Region. These changes are necessary due to a 10th Circuit Court of Appeals decision that reverted our management authority that the state got back to the federal government. So we need to amend the Taking Utah Prairie Dog Rule and repeal the Taking Non-Game Mammal Rule. Actually, I said that backwards. We need to amend the Taking Non-Game Mammal Rule and repeal the Taking Utah Prairie Dog Rule. So the Utah Prairie Dog was listed as a threatened species back in the 1980s, so all of their management was authorized by the federal regulations of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service up until November of 2014, where U.S. District Court vacated the Fish and Wildlife Service's authority to regulate the take of prairie dogs on private property. So the state of Utah created a new prairie dog management plan for non-federal lands, where we propose the R657-70 Taking Utah Prairie Dog Rule to the Wildlife Board, as well as amended the R657-19 Taking Non-Game Mammal Rule, and that was to be able to have those sync up with our management plan. However, the Fish and Wildlife Service appealed that district court decision. They did that in the fall of 2015, and that decision came out March 29th, and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the district court decision, therefore having prairie dog management go back to the Fish and Wildlife Service. But this 10th Circuit Court decision didn't become effective till August 17th, which returned the management of prairie dogs to the Fish and Wildlife Service and all the regulations of the Endangered Species Act applying to their management. So the state went ahead the next day, and we filed two emergency rule filings. The first was we repealed the Taking of Utah Prairie Dog Rule, and we needed to do this to be consistent with the Endangered Species regulations. And then we also amended the R657-19 Taking Non-Game Mammal Rule to its previous extent before the court decision. So the statute governing these emergency rulemakings has it that we have to come go through the regular process within 120 days. So that's what I'm here to do. So we need to repeal the Taking Utah Prairie Dog Rule, R657-70, in its entirety, and amend the Taking Non-Game Mammal Rule to its format prior to the district court decision. But we also have to make some changes to be in sync with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and federal regulations under the Endangered Species Act. So we need to first change the dates of allowable take. The Fish and Wildlife Service had changed their 4D rule to change the time period for the agricultural 4D permit. And then also the totals for take range-wide, the Fish and Wildlife Service had changed that in our rule, so we need to match theirs. There's also some non-substantive updates for zip codes just for administration of the rule. And failure to adopt these changes would result in that emergency rule filing expiring and the Division of Wildlife having rules in place that violate the Endangered Species Act and other federal regulations. So please accept our proposal as presented.
All right. Do we have any questions from the RAC?
Just one. Is the state planning an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, or are we just going to let the Tenth Circuit stand and live with it?
So the state didn't have a leg to stand on in that court case, so it was PEPPO, a group from Iron County, People for the Ethical Treatment of Property Owners, and so they have petitioned to the Supreme Court, and the state has filed an amicus brief as well as, I believe, 23 other states. So the tough thing is that the Supreme Court gets a lot of court cases, and they only take about 5% of them, so we don't know if it's going to be likely. But
I was just curious about that, to see if it was being pushed farther or what's going to happen.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Okay, comments from the audience. Do we have any comment cards? Okay, comments from the RAC. These are so good. All right, I'll take a motion.
Given the fact that, without their approval, the division would be in violation of federal law, I'll make a motion to accept the proposal from the division.
So we have a motion from Kent Johnson to accept the proposal as presented. A second? And a second from Helene Taylor.
Thank you.
All in favor? All opposed? So unanimously passed. Thank you. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
I tried to skip over you. All right, Colby, you're up. You had a new job.
I did.
Well, congratulations.
Sure. Exciting. I just realized, though, if I'd changed my last slide, to please accept my proposal.
I know. She knows. She knows.
It'll work that way, Colby.
Just click it here. Okay, so thanks. I'm excited to present the division's recommendations for the 2018 Bucks and Bulls and Once-in-a-Lifetime season dates and boundaries. With that, we'll get started. Okay, so in 2018, here are the general season deer hunt dates. Again, a 28-day archery hunt, a 9-day muzzleloader, and a rifle with respective season dates in August, September, and October. Here are the proposed season dates for general season elk hunts, with the archery spike bull hunt, a 21-day hunt, leaving those last 7 days for the limited entry hunters on those units. Archery any bull, a 28-day hunt there. Any weapon, 13 days, and muzzleloader, 9 days. And with that, we'll get right into the recommended changes. So at the Wildlife Board request, they asked us to evaluate the possibility of adding early rifle deer hunts where possible to reduce crowding and address buck doe ratios on units that were continually over objective. What we've run into is that we have a statewide deer plan, and in the plan we've agreed to manage for either 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does or 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does on different units across the state, and do that through hunter harvest and provide hunting opportunity. In some of the units, we've run into issues where we're unable to manage to those. And when we make the recommendation to add permits, there's pushback at the RACs, and, And the pushback is we just don't have the room. We don't have the space to add more hunters to this unit. And some of these units are, you know, approaching or over $30 per 100 does, so way above what we've agreed to manage to with our public. So when we evaluated this, we looked at the units around the state that were continually over objective or had these issues of either private lands or crowding issues. These would be good units to try this on. So with that background, we recommend an early season rifle hunt on the Camas, on the Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, South Ridge. That's one unit. On the 9 Mile, on the Fillmore, in the southern region, on the Fillmore, the Fish Lake, the Panguitch Lake, the Pine Valley, and the Zion. And the season dates would be, the recommended season dates are October 10th through the 14th. And that overlaps the general season spike, any bull hunts. That season runs longer. It runs the 6th through the 18th. And the season would include a weekend, one weekend. Start on a Wednesday and include one weekend. So there's some trade-off here. When we did the deer survey in 2014, before we wrote the statewide mule deer plan, we also asked, would hunters like the ability to hunt elk and deer at the same time? Is that something they'd be interested in? And it was overwhelmingly positive. That would be a great opportunity. Some of the reasons, I only get a few days off for work, and taking days off for elk and deer hunts is difficult. And so this provides, even though there's some give and take, it's a shorter season, but it does provide that overlap and that ability to hunt both at the same time. And this is what the general season deer hunt dates would look like with that included. Okay, another Wildlife Board request was to look at the possibility of adding late season limited entry muzzleloader deer hunts on all general season units that are currently meeting their minimum buck to doe ratio objectives. So this is one, I think right up front, it's fair to acknowledge, and the RAC needs to know, this recommendation currently in the statewide deer plan, this is happening on units that are managed for 18 to 20 and that are exceeding their objective. And that is according to plan. However, this recommendation to move it to all units that are meeting their objectives is against, it violates the plan. It's against the plan. And I just want to put that out there so that everybody understands that. The data that we presented to the Wildlife Board, the deer draw odds are the hardest in the state. In Utah, we have a great system. I feel very lucky to have the opportunity to hunt deer almost every year, and also the ability to put in for a limited entry unit and dream about the ability to hunt one of these great units with high buck to doe ratios and great quality deer as well. And as long as we run two systems, it's important that we try and legitimize both systems. And this is an attempt to do that. This is an attempt to say, yes, we're working hard to provide opportunity on our general season units, but we also need to look at providing opportunity. It's not going to be the same opportunity. We also need to look at legitimizing the limited entry system. And that's what this does. When we looked at the hunter satisfaction in these hunts, hunters are burning up to 17 points to draw one of these tags. The comments that we got back were, this is a great hunt. I wish it would have been later in the rut. It's not a rut hunt. It happens early in November and it closes before the 10th. There aren't a lot of permits in these currently, and we've agreed to keep the number of permits in this hunt low. Currently there are about 165 permits that in 2017 that were in this hunt. Another thing we realized that in doing this, that inadvertently, the way that we wrote it into the plan, it created a mixed message. And that was that, well, if you manage your unit inappropriately and you exceed $20 per 100 does, then you're rewarded with a limited entry hunt. This recommendation would fix that. It would say there are enough deer on the landscape, there are enough bucks on the landscape. Manage the unit appropriately. Manage it at 15 to 17 or 18 to 20, and we can still do this and not negatively impact the population or the general season hunters. So with that background, we would recommend adding late season limited entry muzzleloader hunts on all general season deer units in 2018. Another statewide change is a multi-season elk permit on spike and any bull units. This would allow hunters the ability to hunt archery, muzzleloader, and any weapon during the corresponding general season hunt dates. And a little bit on how it would work, because it kind of, it could be a little bit confusing, but hunters would come in and they would pick either a multi-season or spike any bull, multi-season spike or any bull permit. Those permits would be deducted from the current quotas. So right now there are 15,000 spike permits and 15,000 any bull permits. So when you went to the front counter, you'd say either I want a spike rifle tag or I want a spike multi-season tag. And when you said that, the archery hunt would work as it currently does. You could hunt both. And then when you went into rifle and muzzleloader respectively, you would go into your lane. So if it were a spike tag, you'd be able to hunt that permit on a spike unit. If we're in any bull tag, you'd be able to hunt that permit on an any bull unit. And more as an informational there, the cost would be $150. As part of the regional recommendations in the southern region, recommend adding a cactus buck hunt on the Paunsagunt. Excuse me, I'm sorry. We did some research on these deer last year and just verified that they're not contributing to the population. They don't have any ability to reproduce. And it's a mouth on the landscape that isn't adding. I think it's important to note we're not trying to solve this problem, but we realize that we have a resource there that hunters can take advantage of and use. And this would also be a limited entry hunt. A boundary change on the Mount Dutton Paunsagunt and Plateau Parker Mountain Pronghorn units. And this boundary change would just make the buck and doe boundaries consistent. And a name change. The Fillmore Oak Creek renamed Fillmore Oak Creek South for general season any bull and buck pronghorn. One other thing, in the rack packet there was a mistake on the Zion bighorn sheep. The early hunt said that it went through the 10th, and that closes on October 12th, and then the late hunt opens on October 13th and runs through the 10th. In the southeastern region, recommending adding a LaSalle Mountains mountain goat hunt. We've surveyed that population, and we have a sustainable population and have the ability to have a hunt there. And a boundary change on the 9 Mile Jack Creek. This extends the boundary to incorporate Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep on the north book cliffs. In the northern region, it's Utah's turn for the Box Elder Pilot Mountain Rocky Mountain bighorn permit with the season dates there. And a boundary change to the Cache Extended Archery Area. And this would expand that boundary to help address some depredation issues and urban deer concerns. So it allows hunters to help us address those issues. In the northeastern region, a simple season date change on the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Elk. The new season dates would be August 18th through December 15th. The elk hunt, this would make the elk hunt open on the same day for archery season and the Uinta Basin Extended Archery, and it aligns the hunt with the Wasatch Extended Archery season. In the central region, the Wasatch Front mountain goat population has struggled over the last several years, and we've watched that population in areas decline. We lumped these three units together several years ago in an attempt to have a larger population to hunt, and inadvertently, we realized that not all of these units are equal, and that is that the Box Elder Peak and Lone Peak are more difficult to access than the Temp. And so we recommend splitting those units back out into three separate units to prevent over-harvest on Temp. In addition to that, I recommend combining two Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep units, the Central Mountains Nebo, Wasatch Mountains West, and the Wasatch Mountains of Inequin. And this will allow us to have a larger number of accessible rams. It'll allow us to be able to leave this hunt open and not turn it off and turn it back on. So that's the change there. This change would remove the language concerning alternating closures between the sportsman permit holder and the statewide conservation permit holder. And a boundary change to the Box Elder Petal Valley Pronghorn Unit. And this cleans up the boundary out there. There's some military ground. It cleans up the boundary with the military ground and the county. Here are a couple key dates. The application period starting January 25th through March 1st, and then extended 15 days for the ability to buy bonus points and preference points. And results posted May 31st. The bottom there, the purchasing and selling of antlers, heads, or horns of legally taken big game. The Southern region saw this, and you're seeing this, and we'll call the other rack chairs and make sure they're aware of this. This date used to be February 15th through July 31st, and we had a member of the public bring it to us and say, what is the purpose behind this? And the purpose behind it is to not have the ability to sell these while hunts are open. And at some point in time, there were hunts that ran through the 15th, and that's no longer accurate. Our hunting seasons all end by the 31st of January, and so where we didn't have a good reason, he said, so if I want to sell a skull on February 6th, that's illegal? The answer is yes, but we don't have a defensible reason to leave it there, so we recommend moving that back to February 1st. And here are the key dates for hunt extensions for hunters with disabilities. And with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
All right, so do I have any questions from the RAC?
Sure.
A few of them.
Okay.
Your late season muzzleloader hunt, you say it's not in any of the rut at all? You don't have any rut starting by then?
Well, I mean, deer start.
And let me preface that, because you say people are burning 17 points to do it. I'll tell you why they're doing it. It's easy to do. And I think you know that. But you tell me.
Is that a question?
That's a question. Are there bucks rutting by the time that hunt starts?
So, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer. The answer is every buck in full rut. We close it down pretty early, not past the 10th. There could be some bucks that are exhibiting rutting behavior during that time. I've been out in the field, and I've talked to the hunters. I went out there and talked to them. How's this going? The hunt success, it's lower than limited entry muzzleloader hunts. And the one comment that I've gotten consistently is, it's fun, but this hunt is harder than I thought.
So can you explain to me why they're willingly burning that many points on this hunt?
Yeah, they're...
It doesn't make sense. Go ahead.
There are units in the state where there's the ability or possibility to harvest a great buck.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to ask questions? Okay.
Chairman, you can do whatever the hell you want.
Great. Wow. Once in a while, doesn't happen in my life very often. Can you tell me where that recommendation came from for this limited entry late season muzzleloader hunt? Do you know where it came from?
So I do know the history. Okay. It started in the mule deer plan as a possibility on units that were, like I explained, that were exceeding their buck doe ratios. And the positive feedback that members of the wildlife board had got from the public was, so this is a great hunt. They really enjoyed the hunt. So they contacted the wildlife board, members of the public, and said that. So the board asked us as an action item, will the division look into this and see if it's possible to extend this further? I'm trying to, full disclosure here, that it's not completely congruent with the plan, but the same board that approves the plan, changes the plan, modifies the plan, is the board that asks the division to look into it.
Right. Go ahead, Darren.
So just a clarification, on those deer hunts, is that from the current number of tags sold, or is that in addition above what the state currently sells with those deer hunts?
So they're limited entry permits, so they would be in addition to the current limited entry permits that are out there.
But I mean, so if the state sells 92,000 permits, is this in addition, maybe 94,000 or 95,000? What's that?
It's not in addition to the recommended number of permits. When we bring out permit numbers, these numbers are included in those numbers. So last spring we brought out the recommendation of 165 permits of this type over 15 units, and that was the number. It's not anything in addition to what's recommended or approved.
You didn't take these permits from any general season permits. They are basically added to their additional permits.
Is that the question? Are we pulling permits back out of the general season to be able to have this hunt? And the answer is no. We're not pulling permits back out of our general season recommendations in order to have this hunt, nor would we.
I have a question as to why it's just muzzleloader. I mean, any particular reason why it's limited to muzzleloader? Why not primitive weapon, let archers apply as well?
I guess that comes back to what the intent was in the plan, and that was to allow muzzleloader. This is a muzzleloader hunt.
I have a few questions on your early season hunts. You know, right now the proposal is just to go with the units that are over objective, which is where the late season muzzleloader hunter started, and because of public demand, now here we are looking at going statewide. Do you see any potential for the same thing happening with the early season hunts, the public coming now and wanting a statewide early season hunt on every unit?
Eric, that's a great question. Really, a lot of what we do in wildlife management is social. And it's our job as biologists to stand up and say, okay, this could be biologically damaging or this could be biologically damaging. But how we manage inside of that is to the best of our abilities and trying to provide hunters opportunities to be in the field, to manage to what we've agreed to manage. So, again, I wouldn't say that we would never receive a request from the public to look at expanding this to other units. But right now, this is our recommendation.
Okay. Next question. Late season muzzleloader hunts. I understand the reason for that, to help with the point creep in the limited entry system. How many tags are we talking, and how are those tags allotted throughout each unit? Is it based on a percentage, or?
Currently, we have 15 units and 165 permits statewide. It's very few. If we have a hunt, we recommend at least five, and allow for one out-of-state permit as well. But I don't have the numbers right here. We can get those to you, Eric.
I guess one of the concerns would be like with the manta or the southeast manta. You know, we're supplementing the deer herd because it's the overall numbers are bad, and I wasn't sure. I wanted to have a clarification of, you know, how those tags, because if it's based off a percentage of the general season tags, I could see the manta getting a lot because it's one of the highest number of tags, general season tags.
Sure. And I understand that concern. We've committed to keep the numbers low, and I believe we followed through with that with, again, 165 on 15 units.
Okay, and the last question, with the elk, the multi-season elk hunts, has there been any concern or thought given to the fact that due to more opportunity for each hunter, we could have much higher hunter success rates on the spike hunts, and what that could do to the overall quality of the mature bulls we're selling limited entry elk tags for?
Yeah, we've talked about that. I guess I'd first say we don't have that concern, but if we see success rates increase, there are triggers in the plan to reduce permits, and we could reevaluate that at that point.
I've got a question about the elk as well. Kind of where did that recommendation come from as far as the three season? And we're concerned with overcrowding in the elk, I mean in the deer, and it seems like that's just going to increase overcrowding on an elk hunt.
Yeah. Really, we're talking about a completely different scale of overcrowding. You know, Eric brought up a great point, and that is the manti. We issue almost 9,000 deer tags on the manti alone. Elk permits statewide 15,000 on spike units and 15,000 on any bull units. It's not even at the same scale. And the other thing is that it could reduce crowding in a way. If archery hunters currently aren't counted in that quota, and if they elect to buy one of these multi-season permits, then we might have fewer hunters out on the landscape. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and where did this idea come from? Was that also from the Wildlife Board?
This is an idea we've heard from sportsmen. We'd like more opportunity, and in the statewide plan, it directs us to seek opportunities to do these things. So it's part of the statewide elk plan.
Question with the multi-season elk tags on the spike units. Would that permit still be in either sex on during the archery hunt?
For the archery hunt, spike units,
it would still be either sex?
Yes. To avoid confusion, the archery hunt would be handled exactly the same way as it is now.
Explain that. You lost me.
To avoid confusion, if you elected one of the multi-season elk permits, the archery season would be handled the same way that it is now. So during the archery season, you could either hunt a spike or an any bull unit and also harvest a spike or a cow on a spike unit or an any bull or any elk on an any bull unit.
Okay, at this time, questions from the audience.
Madam Chairman, hold on. We have an issue. It's not on our action log, but it is germane to the subject. Do you want to bring this up after the rest of this has gone through, or do you want to go through with it now? I know there's questions here, and there's also questions in the audience.
Is it a question or a comment?
There's a lot of both.
And it pertains to
this?
Yes,
ma'am. It'll fall under the once-in-a-lifetime. How do we do that, Mr. Albrecht? Can you help us with that?
Sure. I don't know that I'm the judge or jury, but if it's a... It may fall under comments just because there's probably going to be comments and probably fall under the comment section.
Okay, so how do we bring the comments up from the public as well?
Just have them write down the item number and.
So they've got yeah. those cards, yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. So they're under this item. Yes. So I guess we can just. Can I ask my questions now?
Yeah.
This pertains to a buffalo unit you guys added or expounded. Do you want to answer the questions, or do you want to call for some help?
If it's a regional issue, I think that it would be appropriate for the region to answer those questions.
Okay. Sorry, Brad. I apologize. Can you inform us on the current buffalo issue in the Desolation Canyon Range Creek area?
Yeah, we have some bison on the west side of the river where we don't want them. We don't have a management plan for bison on the Range Creek unit, so we're trying to get rid of them.
Can you tell me how many you have now and how many you have had in the past?
Yeah, it varies from year to year. This year we're roughly 150 head on the west side of the river right now.
Right now?
In past winters, it's well more than that. In the heart of winter, there's quite a bit more than that.
So according to the RAC meeting last November, your tribal rep over there said there's upwards to 280 head, correct? They moved in one day.
Yeah, there could easily be that many on the west side of the river, yeah.
Can you tell me the DWR's current plan to handle the issue, as well as the current issue in the Uinta Basin, the Book Cliffs area, and the Thompson Canyon with buffalo out of their units?
I can. that all right? Okay. We expanded the boundary so we can kill bison if they show up on the west side of the river. We have hunters afield right now as we speak. We have an agreement with the tribe where they're pushing bison back across once we can't get in there to hunt them anymore. And they're doing a bunch of other projects to really long-term help the situation on the tribal land so bison would want to stay there and not migrate here.
How successful have these steps been?
Well, a lot of them time will tell.
Long-term success. Getting rid of the buffalo is what my question is.
Well, we're about 4 days into hunting, so not very good so far. This is the first season we're hunting them, and we're kind of, we'll see after the season's over, but yeah.
What keeps us from getting more aggressive on our management methods?
Nothing really, just access into the canyon. Once the snow flies, you can't get there anymore, so you really can't hunt bison you can't get to.
Okay.
Okay, so I think at this point, I know this is a huge concern.
Yes,
I
ma'am.
Received letters, and I believe, and maybe I can have Justin help me here, that this really needs to be another action item that goes, is that correct, to, or maybe Kevin can help me. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if right now is the time to handle this issue. It's a fairly large issue.
Well,
it's really important.
We created this hunt in this meeting. I believe that according to Stacy Coombs, we can talk about this in this meeting.
In the spring, when we do permit numbers, we could recommend to have 1,000 tags out there.
Need to talk about the hunt itself, not numbers.
Okay. We could. Really, what we do is season dates and boundary is something we can.
The boundaries is a huge issue here.
Okay.
So I suggest we really go through the rest of your finish up with your big bucks and bulls and come back to this after this is over.
Maybe a comment from
that. Okay with you? I'm not the boss here.
Yeah. So tonight we're approving hunt boundaries, which this is certainly a hunt boundary that can be discussed, and we're also setting season dates. So I don't think it would be a separate agenda item. I think it's okay. a hunt that's in the RAC packet already that okay. we can certainly have the discussion on.
Okay.
So do we continue, or do you want to go a different direction?
Do you have more questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay, go back to the question. What keeps us from getting more aggressive on our methods, management methods?
I think we had 10 tags out there last year. We did 50, 47 this year. So we just wanted to see how many people we can fit into the canyon. We'll see how it goes. And if we can get them all in there, we'll increase it next year. Really, access is our main impediment to being more aggressive with our tools, which are sportsmen.
Okay. We added this boundary change last fall.
Correct, this time last year.
Why was private landowners, public grazing leaseholders, BLM, CITLA, the University of Utah, Carbon, or Emory County not involved in this decision-making process?
They were. It was at this meeting last year. It's a public meeting.
But they were not informed that we were proposing a change in this.
Yeah, it was in a RAC packet just like this year. Yeah, a similar thing.
Is it standard procedure that we don't ask, we just do?
We look for input, but it's not required to go to all the landowners on certain things. I can certainly go out and look for input and when it's necessary.
Okay. In prior meetings we've had with the DWR, they said they cannot do anything because of the issue because they are tribal buffalo. If the DWR does not own the buffalo and therefore cannot do anything to remove them, how do they have the right to sell 42 tags, and this is off your internet numbers, to harvest them?
That's been the difficult thing is what are these bison once they leave tribal lands? Are they wildlife once they're on BLM or non-tribal lands? I think we've determined their wildlife, and we're just using every tool we can.
Okay. So according, and yet again, rely back on the RAC meeting last November in the Uinta Basin, the DWR claims management authority on any game off of tribal land. Do we agree on that?
I believe so. An elk, a deer, yeah, they're...
Okay. If we have a zero target objective in the 9-mile unit, why have we limited it to 42 tags? Is it because of your access issues?
Once again, you've driven that road. You can't fit 200 people in there.
That's what I wanted you to say. What is the current access situation into the 9-mile unit to harvest the buffalo at their current location?
That depends. I assume we're talking Range Creek primarily.
Range Creek and Desolation Canyon.
Right. Because there's several hundred bison on the 9-mile unit that are very accessible up by Sand Wash. And harvest there will be pretty good. But the access is rather difficult in Range Creek, controlled by some other interests and just the terrain.
So just so everybody's aware, Range Creek Canyon is only accessible by foot or horseback. You have to have a purchased day pass to go in. Currently, just talked with the guy that the buffalo are 9 miles down the canyon from the lock gate. So if you're going to walk or ride 9 miles in one day, harvest a buffalo and pack it out and be out before daylight. Sounds pretty challenging to me. Question on why the access wasn't stated in the hunt description.
Because there's a million other places to harvest the buffalo. We're not requiring them to harvest in Range Creek. There's other issues as well.
Well, it's a whole issue. So, I mean, I realize it's not just Range Creek.
Right.
Desolation Canyon, which where the bulk of these buffalo are right now, you can't get to other than if you float on a boat for 5 days.
Right. The hunters we've called and asked to come down, we give them a list of all these things, the permit they have to get, the access, the things like that.
Okay. What's your projected success rate for this hunt?
Have no idea. Yeah.
I'm on throw a ballpark.
I mean, it could snow tomorrow and we're done. And I think there's snow in the forecast, so.
What is the rest of your day, or your hunt, buffalo or bison success rates for the state?
I don't know offhand. Anyone else hazard a guess? I don't have any bison units.
85% with a 3.5 days in the field. I'm almost done.
While he pauses a second since we're on this, let me ask you a question. Have you guys given any thought to your season dates on the buff bison in Thompson, Floyd, Sago? Is 4 years ago, I think I brought it up, and there was 50-some head down in there. And 2 springs ago, I went up in there and pushed 60-plus head ahead of me up the canyon. And I know you've got over 100 head in there now, and it's just increasing. And they're not in there till your bison hunt closes. Have you guys given thought to anything to rectify that?
I think that's in code where we can't hunt in February through June.
Serious?
Yeah. Is that the case?
So what are you going to do when this becomes a huge problem? Because it's getting there really fast.
What we can do is use sportsmen as a tool and get them when they're available.
They're on the reservation.
We're working on that as well. That we don't have management jurisdiction when they're on the reservation.
I know that. But when they come off, your hunts are closed, is what I'm saying. And I don't believe your predation rate on bison is significant in any way. And I think you're going to run into tons of problems real fast. And you're nodding your head because you know. Yeah.
Yes.
You say it's by code you can't hunt those dates. Does that include a depredation hunt as well?
Yes. I don't know. Yes.
Seriously? Wow.
What is the DWR doing to prevent the risk of transferring disease from unvaccinated, untested buffalo, such as brucellosis, tuberculosis, and other diseases, to livestock and other wildlife on public range? And also, you brought up the point, you have these buffalo in the water source in the town of Thompson. In the water source. So that is an issue on human disease. Am I wrong? Talking with the state vet this afternoon, they are extremely worried about this.
Okay. On bison that are on public lands, on the book cliffs, we disease test, we catch and do some disease tests and blood testing on those each year we have since we released them. The Ute tribe also gathers a large number, it varies, as many as they can, and test them, maintain brucellosis freeze status.
Do we have any proof that that's getting done, or is it just the Indians saying they're doing it?
They're gathered. I don't have the paperwork in my hand. They have to do it, but I don't have it.
I have one question. Why can you not hunt them during the time they're there? Is that a state law? Is it a regulation? Why can't you?
I don't know.
There's a lot that goes into that, but part of it is that it's pretty late in gestation. And so we have to take into account a lot of different things, stressing an animal during that time, gestation, other factors that go into when it's appropriate to hunt and harvest and when it's not. Love to have that conversation with you after.
Yeah, it just seems to me if you're going to have any ability to control numbers at all, you're going to have to change your management plan.
Last one, and I'm done. What are the buffalo doing in the critical winter habitat for deer, elk, feral horses, and livestock in these areas?
They're grazing on those winter ranges as well.
They're decimating them. And there's many people in this room that have seen it firsthand. It's decimation. The BLM claims they do not have enough AUMs for deer, elk, horses, and livestock. And now we have another 280 head of buffalo on top of that.
Is there a season date or boundary change we should propose here?
Well, I think we're
getting
through, I think we have to go through everyone else's questions, and then yeah, we do have one.
I have a question as to the percentage of the buffalo that are being tested. Like, what's the percentage of the herd that's actually being tested?
I don't know exactly. They gather as many as they can. I don't know.
Okay, any more questions from the rack? At this time, we'll take questions from the audience. Is that correct? Do you have them? Oh, yeah. Just make sure that if you have a question, you state your name. All right, so we're going to go to comments from the audience, and we're going to start with, do you want me to list them like that? Okay, Kobe Hunt from the Emory County Farm Bureau.
Hello, my name is Kobe Hunt, and I'm representing Emory County Farm Bureau and myself. I run cows up in where these bison are coming down also, and so I have a lot of the same concerns that Jeff does. Also, I have a big problem next to the Indian Reservation. The bison are coming through my barbed wire fence up there, and they're knocking it down, and then my cows are allowed to go on the Indians. And I can't go on the Indian reservation to get my cows back. So the Indians can round up my cows, take them, and sell them. And so it's basically legal theft, if you want to call it that. So I have I'm coming to the board to ask you guys to help me work with the Indians or fly in a pipe metal fence that I can weld together up there or do something to help me keep my fence up with the bison. And that's all I have.
Thank you.
Okay, what was you asking? Oh, so the other comment's not on the bison. It's more on, I would like to see a boundary change on the Manti-Nebo unit for deer. When they built that boundary, I kind of feel like it's pretty tough to hunt Green River. Green River is basically where the corner of four areas. I don't know, where we used to hunt around here a lot, we can't anymore. I would like to see the boundary change from the Green River to Woodside, take in the Price River, and then go down Highway 10 to I-70 and split that. That's a big unit, the Manti unit is, and I would like to see it split down some and let Green River have our, let us be able to hunt the valley and the fields and be able to hunt the desert. So that's one proposal I had. And then I would also like to see a late season, either muzzleloader or primitive weapon or whatever on the book cliffs for deer. I would kind of view it as the same as the LaSalle Dolores Triangle unit. We hunt the late over there for the, so that when the deer come down off of Colorado, we can hunt them. I see a lot of good bucks from Sago over to Floyd to Tusher. A lot of these big bucks, I see them, they pull down. They pull down for several years, and then I don't see them anymore. And I think they're dying of old age or something, and I think that's a waste of a resource. I would really like to see those bucks killed up in there, and I think a late hunt would help that.
Okay, thank you. All right. Dallas Leo from Utah Bowman's Association.
I'm here on behalf of Utah Bowman's Association, and we do support the DWR's recommendations on not only number 7, but agenda number 8 as well. And we concur with SFW on the bighorn sheep archery only on the Oak Creek and the other two proposed ram changes as well. That's it.
Thank you. Next, Butch Jensen, Utah Cattlemen.
Awful tall for a short guy. Butch Jensen, we're owners of Tavaputs Ranch up on the book cliffs up here. A lot of this buffalo discussion is really having an effect on our operation up there. All those Indian buffalo are coming across the Green River onto our Desolation Canyon permit, and also coming around into Range Creek now on the University of Utah. We're extremely concerned about the brucellosis. Nobody can really rear back and guarantee us 100% that this isn't going to become an issue, both for our livestock and for our game. Also, we're extremely concerned that with these buffalo coming across the river and coming onto the west side of the river, they're eating all of our elk habitat, elk and deer habitat, let alone our cattle habitat. Back in the 80s, we planted elk on the Tavaputs, and that herd has become a real great unit. We've been as high as 2,300 elk. We're down to about 1,300 now. We're really concerned that this buffalo grazing is going to taking away our feed for the game. I could go on all night about all of our concerns. What I would really like to propose, or I don't know if that's the right word or not, to this board. We've got this temporary buffalo hunt going on right now, and the real issue is in Desolation Canyon, Range Creek and whatnot. But when this unit got made, it's not just Desolation Canyon. It comes clear to Green River, clear up Highway 6, over the mountain towards Duchesne. This unit is huge, and our concerns that somewhere down the line, these buffalo keep coming, that this thing is going to become a unit. We would like to see this board have a discussion and have a vote on it and send it up to the big game thing that this is not going to become a buffalo unit on the west side of the Green River. There's just too many dangers in this with the brucellosis, the loss of the habitat. It just goes on and on. So anyway, I appreciate you letting me talk about it.
Thank you, Butch. Right. Comments from the... Oh, we do? Okay. Corey Viteri.
Corey Viteri. I own BLM grazing permits here in the Book Cliffs. And
It's on the east side of the river. When you guys proposed to plant the buffalo up there, I come in to protest, and at that time, my grazing permits weren't in the buffalo or bison unit. And so they didn't even listen to what I had to say. And now the bison winter on my permit, and I can't use it. And it was part of the divisions. At the time when Cunningham sold out, I went to the Ute tribe, and we subleased their grazing there. Cunningham had it before us. And then the division didn't like my cows up there because they wanted buffalo. And so I have emails that they sent to the Ute tribe with pictures of my cows on state land saying that they were on tribal grounds, which caused the Indians to shoot approximately 40 head of my cows. They gathered 32 and took them to the Uinta Basin and sold them, and nobody would step up and defend me. Because the division just moved in, moved me out of the way, and now they're buffalo at my grazing permits for winter. So these guys on the west side, I'm behind them all the way. And what's wrong is wrong. If I wasn't in the unit, they should have got rid of the buffalo when they come on to my ground. And I can just see them moving clear down, being out here on the flats and taking over everything.
Thank you. John Viteri?
John Viteri, represent myself. I'm on a different subject. I put in on Henry Mounts for 14 years. Black powder. I had to mark a little box telling me they're going to overrun my hunt with a management buck hunt. Well, I'm not very happy, but I marked the box anyway. Of course, I didn't draw. A friend of mine drew for the rifle. Well, guess what? The rifle season ends Sunday. The management buck starts Monday. Well, we went up there fighting with everybody in the world. How many people's on that mountain with you? You cannot control that. You only give so many permits. Every place to turn around to see a big buck, somebody's there. Nobody has a gun, but they got spotting scopes. All right, 3-4 days into the hunt, they finally left. Okay, about 3 inches of poof dirt. You've been on the Henry. There's either dirt or there's rocks, so you're fighting one or the other. All right, finally, we kind of got the mountain a little to ourselves. Thursday, we're coming back off the mountain about noon. New camps. They weren't there the morning we went up. We stopped and talked to people. Oh, yeah, we have a management buck hunt. This is Thursday. They're going to hunt Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday chasing a deer worse than they've been chased forever. And then you're hunting on Sunday, and there starts Monday. I think we have way too many permits. And what I've seen on the Henrys, I've never been so disappointed in my life. There's no need for a management buck hunt on, as far as I'm concerned. If so, at least put it some other time. Thank you.
And then Troy, SFW.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendations with, you know, two exceptions. I passed some papers out to you. The first of which I'd like to address is the archery-only hunt for bighorn sheep. This is part of what we came around last year with. We recommended to the RACs and also the Wildlife Board that we start a archery-only once-in-a-lifetime hunt for bighorn sheep, for mountain goats, and bison. The board adopted the mountain goats and the bison. We believe they've been successful, so this time we've come back around and proposed that we start some archery-only hunts on the Zion for desert sheep, and then for California bighorns on the Newfies. This has been voted upon on the other RACs. It's passed, and we'd ask this RAC also to address this and vote on this particular issue. The other one is, you know, the oak cricks. We put California bighorns on the oak cricks about 8 years ago. Based upon recent surveys, we believe that there is a huntable population there. We ask that the division open that up next year to some permits to allow the taking of a California bighorns on that unit. Speaking to the recommendations from the division, roughly Sports Fish and Wildlife has about 7,000 members throughout the state. There is a couple of sticking points, one of which is these late season muzzleloader. Quite honestly, half of our membership's in favor of it and the other half's not. I think the key thing, the only reason why we could support it is to keep, if we're going to do these, have these hunts, we keep, need to keep these numbers in, very low, not a lot of, maybe 5, 10, 15 permits at most. And if the units can't hold withstand that, then don't have that hunt on those units. The other one was the elk, but we also agreed to support the multi-season elk. Thank you. Just one thing on the bison. Just you asked, you know, as far as success on hunting bison. I've hunted bison a lot. Once you pressure bison, it can become the toughest hunt there is. They'll move for pressure. They'll change freaking counties. And I sympathize with the livestock operators here. We need to do something. But quite honestly, you're not going to solve the problem until the neighbors are willing to address the problem with on their own property. The reason why these bison are moving out is in large part to your wild horses or feral horses. In years past, and being on the reservation there and flights with them, in one area alone, we counted 1,300 horses. I think their objective for bison's 400 to 600. Last I heard, they believe they were currently over 1,200. They got to eat. They're going to continue to move. And so this is going to be an ongoing problem until, you know, we can control it with inside those boundaries. So.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we're going to move on to comments from the RAC and or recommendations.
I have a comment that's kind of a question that stemmed from one of the public comments. Someone recommended adding a late-season muzzleloader hunt on the book clip unit. Where's that unit as far as objective?
It's, you know, it's a 25 to 35 buck sprinter does, and we're within that. We're 33, I think, right now. So it meets the management objective right now.
Can I speak to that? Correct me if I'm wrong, Kobe, but I think your point was being able to hunt the bucks that are wintering on the BLM and the South Book Cliffs west of Thompson Canyon, and they live on the Indian Reservation during the summer. And they're wintering on our ground, and what Kobe, I think, was talking about is an opportunity to hunt those bucks. And we have deer and elk, in addition to the buffalo, that are coming off the Indian land and wintering on the BLM, especially right here in, like, Tusher and Floyd and Thompson Canyon. Is that right, Kobe? That kind of, okay. Yeah.
And they're never getting killed. It's a waste of a resource, as far as I'm concerned.
Other comments or recommendations?
I have a recommendation. Okay. I recommend removing the 9-mile unit from the Book Cliffs Wild Horse Bench bison hunt. This will untie the hands of the DWR and other agencies to actively and aggressively remove the buffalo from the west side of the Green River by killing or capturing and removing bison that have moved off buffalo management areas.
Say that again.
All of it?
Yeah, you lost me at the first.
Yeah. Was it that damn confusing? Do you want to break it into two parts?
I'd have to.
I recommend removing the 9-mile unit from the Book Cliffs Wild Horse Bench bison hunt, which will untie the hands of the DWR and other agencies to actively and aggressively remove the buffalo from the west side of the Green River by killing or capturing. I also recommend we remove any buffalo that have come off of the buffalo management areas. So that would include all these buffalo that are coming into Thompson, the buffalo that are they're going down into the farms in the Uinta Basin. Any of those buffalo that are outside of them areas need to be handled. The problem we're getting, and it's all over the state, in my opinion, it's happened in the Henrys, according to all them Henry guys. That started out as a small unit, and they were going to hold those buffalo to this area. We all know that you can't stop a buffalo and you can't hold a buffalo. So as those grow, they move and start spreading out. Well, this area just turned into this area and then turned into this area and this area. So where do you draw the line? I mean, are you going to wait till they're in the hay patches in Green River to do anything? The farms in Wellington? They're already in the farms in the basin. Gordon Van Dyke claimed he watered 30 head all summer, hauling water to his cows, and the state wouldn't even reimburse fuel. This is one of the most invasive animals I've ever seen. We talk about the horse issue, and I agree with you 100%. But this is an issue that the state can handle. We don't have to send this to Congress. It doesn't have to go through the guys. The state can handle this problem if they wanted to. We're going to talk about killing deer that wander into domestic elk facilities. So the DWR proves that they don't have a problem killing game when it comes to wildlife health issues, but when it comes to livestock health issues, it's a no-no. What's the difference? How do we solve the buffalo coming into Thompson?
Okay. So, Jeff, is that a motion?
I make that motion.
Okay. To remove.
Second.
Okay. And then, okay. So, the removal of a bison, I want to state this correctly. Okay. So, removing that.
We probably ought to do it. Probably ought to do it in two motions. So, I make the motion that we recommend we remove the 9 mile unit from the Book Cliffs Wild Horse Bench Hunt.
And we have a second from Helene Taylor. Is that correct? Yes. Okay.
I have a question on the motion. So your intent, your idea is if they remove that, then they can just go in and kill them?
Yeah. Well, either that or haze them off. Right now you have a hunt going on. And I guess I didn't understand what Brad said. This hunt started the 1st of August. And it goes till the end of December or January. They've killed, how many buffalo we killed, Brad?
Less than five, I meant.
How many have we killed in the 9 mile unit? Is that five?
All of them are on the 9 mile.
So I guess another question is if we were targeting these as an issue, why did we lump the other side of the river on this hunt?
Because there's issues up there as well.
Okay. So it was its own hunt. This wasn't at a boundary.
Yeah, it was just the Wild Horse Bench.
It was a new hunt.
It was the Wild Horse Bench there for several years, you know, when tribal bison wandered onto BLM lands east of the river. Yeah. That makes sense?
And to my understanding, the ones that were killed, at least two of them had driving access into Range Creek. Is that correct?
Yeah. And several have been killed up on the upper part of the unit as well. So
in our problem area, Range Creek 9 Mile, it's the only part... Range Creek and Desolation Canyon, have we killed any buffalo other than the drive-in access?
Well, the first wave of them are arriving tonight and in the morning. So, yeah. These bison arrived a little over a week ago, so.
Understandable. Yeah. So number one, they can't, with an active hunt going on, they're not going to go hunt, run them off. To my understanding, the tribe tried to come get them last week and we said don't come get them?
No. They ran them with a helicopter three times last winter, pushed them all the way. They sent a little less than 100 to slaughter. We had GPS collars on several of these bison. They came back. You know, it kept them away for a week, but they came back. They have agreed to do that again this winter. Our tactic is remove some permanently while we can, while we have access, and then allow the bison or the tribe to use the tools they have. Because the dead ones never come back.
I understand that. And I agree with you. I love dead buffalo. It's the greatest thing in the world.
You and me both.
But by having this hunt, we cannot actively remove these buffalo.
Is that true, Brad?
That's the only tool we have to remove buffalo. It seems odd to take that away.
But right now you have a hunt going on. You can't even check. I guess it would look really bad for the division if you were to be chasing buffalo out of Range Creek back to the tribe right now. They're going to kill a few. I'm going to tell you that. But even if we killed 110%, I'll give you a handful of good gut shots. This is a multi-10-year project if they never had any calves and if they never brought any buddies with them. So, in my opinion, the hunt's not doing anything to solve the problem. You're going to have a handful of hunters kill, and other than that, we're stuck with buffalo.
Is it possible to do like some type of a nuisance hunt? I mean, if they become a nuisance animal, I know there's times with other animals when they become a problem, they're removed. Is there something that can be done? My thought was, if they have that issue, you have people who have dozens of points applying for these buffalo hunts. We have access issues. So if I've been putting in for 20 years, do I want to burn my points on being able to only possibly hunt for a week or two? Is it possible to do some type of a special hunt to where they don't burn those points if they don't harvest, or there's some other type of nuisance objective that can be met for this to help get some of these buffalo out?
Let me cut you off here, Brad. According to the BLM, one hunter commented, "I've spent $400 and 18 points for a depredation hunt."
Okay, so we're getting back into questions, and I think we need to move along to comments or motions, just to keep moving along.
I understand your concern, and I think something has to be done, but I guess I fail to see where eliminating that hunt would be helpful. Because I'm kind of seeing it as, like Brad said, it's the only way, and as Troy mentioned, if they get some pressure, they'll move. But if you eliminate the hunt, you eliminate any possibility of pressure.
So what keeps these, after they get shot at twice, going out around the point of last chance until they get snowed in and nobody, and they come right back?
I don't know that they'll...
We propose they build a fence out on the point of last chance. We rode out there with the BLM, the state. We measured it. We even had a budget on what it was going to cost.
Okay. We really need to... So let's go back to your motion, removing the 9-mile unit from the Book Cliffs Wild Horse Bench Hunt. And we have a second on that. And let's vote on that. And then we'll move on, if that's okay. Okay? So... All in favor of that motion? So we have, is that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in favor? We need names. Or is, okay. And opposed? Do I vote? And those that are opposed are Kirk, Blair, Jay Skyman, Eric Luke, and Darren Olson. Okay, so that passed. That motion passed. Okay, so let's move on to the next comments or motions.
While we're on it, let's get it over with. My second part of that is somehow we need to actively pursue these animals that are leaving these buffalo management units. I don't know if we can put a directive on the board to get some kind of recommendations or whatever we need to do to get these problem animals that are continually moving leaving the management unit.
So is it... Do you have a motion, or is this something that you want to send back up?
I think this is more a directive to the state board.
Okay.
Ask the board to make it an action item. Is that,
okay. Yeah.
Is that the right way to say that?
What is it? We need to find a solution. I don't know what it is, but I think it's a statewide issue. It's not just our area. It's the Uinta Basin, the Henry Mountains. We need to get them under control.
Do you mind if I make a stab at a motion?
No, sir. Go ahead.
If I get this wrong, stop me and we'll hash it out. We'll make a motion to request the Wildlife Board look into a long-term solution of what to do with buffalo specifically that are leaving current units where they're supposed to be and buffalo that are leaving the Ute Indian Reservation and what to do with them.
I'll second.
Close?
Okay, so you're making a motion to request that the Wildlife Board look into long-term solutions for bison that are leaving current management units.
And the Indian Reservation.
And the Ute Reservation. And do I have a second on that? And that's from Kent Johnson. And a second from Jeff Christensen. Okay, all in favor? All opposed? Nobody? Passes unanimously. That's a great. Any other comments or motions?
I have one with regard to deer hunting. Actually, I'll do two. It'll be two of them. But first, this is something that Kobe Hunt brought up that I've entertained thoughts of and I've had discussions with other people with, and I brought it up last year and I'll bring it up again. And I would, maybe even as a motion, I would like to see the Southeast RAC recommend to the Wildlife Board and the division that we change the boundary units of the South Manti to include the part of the South 9 mile unit from the Price River south to I-70. And that would include and take care of the Green River Valley. And the reason for that is just what Kobe stated. People from Green River are the only ones that ever hunt the valley here. Okay, so we apply for the 9 mile unit, and we draw a tag for 9 mile, and we're restricted to right here in the farmland at Green River. And we'd like to be able to hunt the desert outside of town. Maybe somebody'd like to be able to go over and hunt Farron Mountain or hunt out in the swell. And I think that would be a better alternative. And anybody else throughout the unit that are applying for the 9 mile tag, they draw out 9 mile, they're not coming here to hunt.
All right, so.
So do you want me to state that now I've backgrounded it, you want me to restate the motion?
Yeah, a little cleaner. Condense it, yes, thank you.
Make a motion that we recommend to the Wildlife Board that we change the boundaries of the South Manti to include that portion of the 9 mile unit south of the Price River to the Interstate 70.
Okay. Do we, and that is Kent Johnson, that motion, and do we have a second on that motion?
I'll second it.
Okay, second by Jeff Christensen. All in favor? Okay, passes unanimously. Any other comments or motions?
I'll make a motion that we accept the remainder of the recommendations with these exceptions. We add recommendations that SFW presented by the different sportsmen's groups to add the California bighorn sheep and desert bighorn sheep once-in-a-lifetime archery hunts, and to make the Oak Creek unit open that up to a huntable unit. And the last exception would be to add that late season muzzleloader hunt would go with the recommendations because that would happen on every unit, right? So I don't need to make that. So that's just part of the
I think you know that recommendation and then probably ought to be a separate motion.
Yeah,
because it was specific to an area and it addresses deer that spend their summer on the Indian land and then they winter, they come down off that mountain and winter on the South Book Cliffs.
But if they put a late season muzzleloader hunt on every unit, won't that accomplish
what? General units, Kent.
Them are only general season units they're talking about. And the Book Cliffs is not general season.
My recommendation is maybe we can deal with this SFW request maybe as a separate motion. That's my comment.
We'll address that one later. Okay. So let me restate it. Make a motion that we accept the remainder of that. Does that preclude us from adding that one?
Yeah, we probably ought to do other motions ahead.
Yeah, we need to do other motions. So if you want to deal with this recommendation separately.
Okay, let's start this again. Make a motion that we add a late season muzzleloader limited entry hunt for the Book Cliff unit.
Right.
Eric, could we change your motion a little bit? Just, you know, I have concerns about, you know, getting too much pressure during the rut on deer that are already ours to hunt. So give that a boundary description as well. Say from Thompson Canyon to the green on the Book Cliffs. Excluding tribal land. Because you have to exclude tribal land.
Are you just talking about the South Book Cliffs?
Yeah, just be south. And that would address these big bucks that you see. And I've seen them myself, too, different times. They come down off the Indian land and nobody ever gets to hunt them.
How about I withdraw my motion and you make the motion?
Toby, go ahead with your other motion. Come here. I'm too lazy to walk that far.
Okay, let's go on to a separate motion and tell those guys we gotta keep moving.
My other motion, that's going to preclude us from doing that one, so we need to cover this one. I guess I can make a separate motion that we just that we make a motion to add the bighorn sheep once-in-a-lifetime archery hunts as proposed.
Okay.
And the Oak Creek bighorn sheep hunt as proposed.
I second that.
Okay, so we have a motion by Eric Luke to add bighorn sheep hunt, seconded by Carol Meekum. All in favor of that motion? Was that unanimous, or Kent, were you in favor of that?
I'm in favor.
Okay, so that was unanimous. Okay, next motion. Let's keep plugging along.
Okay, we'll try this one more time. We'll go back to the original motion that we look at adding a Book Cliff late limited entry muzzleloader hunt on the Book Cliff unit. Cover it like you want it?
North or south?
South, he said. So South Book Cliffs.
South Book Cliffs,
south,
yeah.
South Book Cliffs. Yeah, Book Cliffs.
Is there a particular reason you just want it to be muzzleloader? Sorry to break this up, but okay. Is that a better way to state that motion, primitive weapon?
We don't hunt with primitive weapons in Utah anymore.
Well, right.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a primitive weapon.
Yeah. Okay, but there any particular reason it's just muzzleloader?
Can we add archery?
I mean, you could make it archery and muzzleloader. I mean, at the same time, if somebody wanted to do it, I don't think I would be opposed to that.
I'm fine with amending that motion to make it a primitive weapon hunt.
Okay. So we have a motion. Add a late season primitive weapon hunt to the South Book Cliffs. From Thompson Canyon to, were we going to be specific?
Just the South Book.
The South Book Cliffs.
Okay, just South Book Cliffs. Do I have a second on that motion? That's from Eric Luke.
I'll second it.
Okay, Kent Johnson. All in favor? Okay, unanimous pass. Okay, I think we're getting close.
I'll recommend that we accept the remainder of the division's recommendations as presented.
Do I have a second on that? That's from Eric Luke, seconded by Daryl Meekum. All in favor?
Does that help you?
I can't see. Can you guys raise your hand? 2, 3, 4, 8. And opposed? So we have Helene Taylor opposed and Todd.
Thorne.
Thorne, sorry, Todd. Todd Thorne. We're done. Okay. Covey, take it.
Yeah. Sometimes it helps the Wildlife Board on the remainder of these to understand why they were opposed. Would it be okay to ask for just a quick summary from the individuals who opposed that?
My only reason to oppose is that late season limited entry muzzleloader.
Mine likewise. where it states, you know, meeting the minimum objective. Possibly if they were exceeding the objective, that might ease it a little bit, but I don't like the idea of a late season muzzleloader hunt on all the general season deer units.
And I don't get to vote, but my overall comment would just be, and you stated this, it's in violation of the management plan, and I think that's just something to remember. But I have not said that. You don't have to add that. Okay. All right, so let's move on. You're up?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kobe. Yeah. So on to taking big game rule amendments. So do you have any on
Okay. So the following, every once in a while we look at our rules and we tidy things up and we change things that make sense and fix and make sure that everything aligns for law enforcement and that it all still works. So we just looked at the big game rule, and that is not the right button. One of the things that we looked at was archery tackle. The ATA, the Archery Trade Association, just did a national study. And what they evaluated were the limiting factors that might prevent somebody from getting into the sport of archery hunting. In addition to that, they looked at different regulations that vary between state. We took that study and we went to the Hoyt factory, met with the folks at Hoyt, who are archery experts, and some of the members of YUBA, and tried to understand what regulations we had on the books that we could change to make it easier for hunters to get into archery hunting. One of the things that came up was the minimum draw weight. And the minimum draw weight was set at 40 pounds, and that draw weight was set when bows were much less effective than they are today. A current modern bow at 30 pounds produces a lot more energy than one of the older bows at 40 pounds. Also, looking at neighboring states' regulations, either they had no draw weight or 30 pounds. This would help Utah line and help individuals, youth, get into the sport. Another regulation that we looked at was the minimum weight of an arrow. And we recommend removing the restriction on arrow weight of at least 300 grains. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, industry standard, any arrow is going to be above 300 grains. And two, if you're shooting one that's below that, you're probably going to blow up your bow, so if you can find one. When we did this, the study evaluated crossbows as well. And crossbows are considered any legal weapon in Utah, so they're not approved during the archery season. But we looked to see if there's some items there that we could clean up. And we felt like we could remove the requirement for a 24-inch crossbow length and a minimum draw length of 14 inches. And that's because we recommend keeping the following. That is, keep the requirement for a minimum draw weight of 125 pounds and a 16-inch bolt. And those two requirements make the previous requirements not necessary. Add a section on ewe bighorn hunts. So we define the term ewe. Ewe hunts will be considered, recommend they're considered a limited entry hunt with a 5-year waiting period, similar to cow moose hunts. Hunters will lose ewe bighorn points, desert or Rocky Mountain, respectively, so they'll be hunted separately, and other rules will be adjusted accordingly. And this is another tool in the toolbox for the division. We have sheep out of areas that we want sheep. This allows us to call a hunter and have a hunter come and harvest those animals. And really, it's nice to be able to provide that opportunity. It's nice to be able to allow individuals who want to a chance to hunt a ewe that chance. And it makes so the division doesn't always have to do those removals. We had to define the term cactus buck. This is one of the hunts we proposed on the Ponsagant. And we define that the following way. Bucks with any velvet covering the antlers during the season dates established by the Wildlife Board are legal to harvest. This hunt will occur later in November. And the reason we went with this definition, we struggled over this quite a bit and how we would word it. But the reason we went with any velvet is because we wanted something that was enforceable. You know, we talked about writing it differently, but we came back to the fact that the management buck hunt, sometimes you can turn somebody's best day and greatest day into a terrible day if you have an antler that's over an inch long. And we didn't want the same thing to happen on the management buck hunt. If somebody shot a buck that wasn't entirely covered in velvet, it had a scratch of an inch or 2 inches, we didn't want to change that. We feel like we can meet intent of the hunt with this definition. And to make sure that we're doing that, we are going to require success reporting and have mandatory check-ins. We established language to allow for multi-season any bull or spike elk hunts. And this is just further my previous explanation. Hunters choose spike permit or any bull permit. The multi-season spike bull hunters may take an antlerless elk or spike bull on spike units, or any elk or any bull, any elk on any bull units during the archery season. After that season's over, they go into their lane, and they'll be able to harvest a spike bull during their respective muzzleloader and any weapon seasons on spike bull units. The multi-season any bull hunters may take an antlerless elk or spike bull on spike units, or any elk on any bull units during the archery season, or any bull during the respective muzzleloader and any weapon hunts on any bull units. We also clarified some of the language in the spotlighting section, removed the term prima facie and replaced it with probable cause. And this alleviates concerns of violating the presumption of innocence and constitutionality. I feel like I'm using big words like Jessica in her presentation. This makes it so the burden remains on the state to prove all elements of their case, and other administrative rules with spotlighting sections will be updated as well. We added a section on hunter orange to clarify and simplify regulations. Currently, this slide here is what is currently happening. Any legal weapon hunters must wear hunter orange except during a once-in-a-lifetime statewide sportsman or statewide conservation hunt, even if a centerfire rifle is occurring in the same area. So that's current, and the next slide will be the recommended changes. So we recommend changing it so that wearing hunter orange in a CWMU is not mandatory unless required by the CWMU operator. And the reasoning and rationale behind this is that these permits are very few and very controlled. The operator can control the timing of the hunt so hunters don't overlap, and he still has the ability to say, hey, I have multiple hunters on the CWMU right now. Put your orange on. It puts some of the onus back on the operator. Also, the next one is really a clarification. This rule is previously written was very difficult to enforce, and this just clarifies it. And that is, archery or muzzleloader hunters are not required to wear hunter orange, except when hunting in an area where a general season any weapon bull elk or buck deer hunt is occurring. And it just makes it more enforceable for our law enforcement. One thing I would say is that we understand the value of Hunter Orange. If you're out there hunting, we recommend you wear Hunter Orange in the field. With that, these are the recommendations to... And finally, include language to allow for archery-only hunts on once-in-a-lifetime species. And thank you.
Okay. Do you have questions from the RAC?
I have one. So the study is done in other states to reduce the limit on the draw weight. Was there also any data about mortality, wounds on animals that weren't harvested?
Again, I don't want to not answer your question. It's really a question of kinetic energy, and I don't know what other states' mortality rates are. The comment I would make is that there's a lot more to archery hunting than the draw weight. It's time of push at weight equals kinetic energy when it hits the animal.
In your opinion, I mean, would you think that that would increase mortality without harvest?
I think that with modern bows, you have more kinetic energy at 30 pounds than you had with older bows at 40 or even more pounds.
Where did that... I think I have the same concern as Helene does, but... I question why we would
Eric,
do that.
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
Sorry. I question why we would want to lower that rate.
Eric, I can.
Where did that come from? Where?
So it was a national study that evaluated all the states and their archery and what they do, and 40 pounds is one of the things that stuck out. Like, we were the red dot. And further explain maybe a little bit, when this was set, it was set on a recurve or a longbow. Most recurves or longbows are set at poundage at 28 inches. So 40 pounds at 28 inches, right? What if your draw length is 26 and you're shooting a recurve?
You have less.
A lot less.
Yes.
Or if it's 27, it's a lot less. And at the end of the day, it comes down to lethality and kinetic energy. And modern bows at 30 pounds are producing more energy and are more lethal than a recurve or a longbow is at 40 pounds and 28 inches. And when we spoke to the engineers at Hoyt, they just didn't share the concerns that we would have higher wounding or more loss that way.
And my question would be, Hoyt wants to sell bows, right? But if you lower that draw weight, basically what you're doing is allowing for younger kids to be able to hunt. And I would question, I guess, where you say about lethality. Well, it's not just about the bow and the speed and the kinetic energy, but about shot placement. And so if you lower that, the younger...
Are we getting into a comment? Because we might want to keep this for comments.
Well, it kind of leads to a question as to where it comes from. What's the purpose behind it? Because if it's to get youth hunting, that's one thing. But what's the purpose behind the change?
I guess that's the exact purpose, Eric. The purpose is to allow individuals who couldn't draw 40 pounds to draw 40 pounds, whether that be youth or smaller framed females or those who want to get into the sport, and that's the hurdle.
Okay, one other question, two questions actually. With the ewes on the sheep, if they draw the ewe tag, do they lose all their sheep points, or is there a separate points for ewes and rams?
No, that's a good question. These will be handled like cow moose points, and so they're just limited entry points. It's not once in a lifetime. It is not tied to the once in a lifetime ram points.
And then on your cactus buck, I believe the wording was any velvet. So does that mean if there's one tine, one little point that's got an inch and a half of velvet on, is that considered a cactus buck?
Yeah, according to the definition, it would be. These are hard. It's really, really hard to write. And like I said, it comes back to, I know there are officers here that have enforced the Henrys. And you turn a little girl's or a little boy's greatest day into their worst day really, really quickly if that point is over an inch. And so that's why we wrote any velvet instead of full velvet. Full velvet would, and we want to have something that's objective, not subjective.
Yeah, but I see trophy bucks killed every year that have a little strip of velvet still on one point.
So it might be something you recommend during a motion to change the verbiage on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that verbiage because I think you're opening it up to having trophy bucks killed on that hunt. That's not the intent.
Okay, good. Any more questions from the RAC? Okay, at this time, questions from the audience. Do you have any comments from the audience? Okay, no comments. Okay, so do we need to state that? Okay. So at this time, comments or motions from the RAC. And am I allowed to make a comment? So yeah, I've been an archer for a while. To be honest, I can draw quite a bit of weight now, but when I started hunting, I couldn't. And I was skeptical about and I have a very fancy bow that does blankety blank feet per second, and I just didn't feel like it had the punch to do what it needed to do. So I adamantly oppose that drop in draw weight. I think there's a point and a time where we all just don't get a trophy, basically. And there's a time when you know, with a hunter, you build yourself up into being an archery hunter. Basically, you know, it's a challenge. It should be a challenge, and part of that challenge is being able to pull that draw weight. I really worry about wounding a lot of animals, arrows sticking this far out of an animal. That's all I've shot is these new fancy bows, and they still don't, I don't think, have the punch that they need. I've talked to quite a few, you know, people about that, shooting big bulls with 70 pounds drawn and not taking them down and making good shots. So
I agree 100%. I'm opposed to dropping the draw weight. I see nothing but more wounded animals. You talk about kinetic energy and speed versus the weight. And if you lighten the arrow up, they might be a little faster, but a 30-pound bow, 30-pound draw weight bow with a lighter arrow does not create the kinetic energy that a 40-pound bow does. And so basically you're just saying you need less energy to hunt. So that's the way I see it. I don't like that. I don't like that rule change. And I definitely think that the any velvet on the cactus buck needs to be reported.
So why don't we approach those as two different motions, if we want to make a motion on the first. Good point. Are there any other comments in general? Because we can come back to other stuff, right? Okay, let's make a motion on the draw weight if you feel adamant about it.
I'll make a motion that they look at rewording the verbiage on the cactus buck hunt to require at least a certain percentage. I realize that's somewhat susceptible to problems, but at least it does away with the possibility of the trophy bucks being killed on that hunt.
I should have asked during the question, but is there anything else that classifies them as a cactus buck?
Yeah, from a law enforcement standpoint, that won't fly. Sorry. If you're going to tell a hunter he's got a determined percentage, mm-hmm. you'll never prosecute a single soul, ever. Okay. I think that's probably bucks why it says any velvet, because right. this is a nightmare you're jumping on here.
I mean, bucks with antlers that are predominantly covered by velvet. I don't know. Does anybody have a better word than that?
I don't know. I think division's opening a can of worms by even wanting to do this hunt, and I feel really bad for the law enforcement division if they do implement this hunt. And my personal opinion, I'm not making this as a motion unless somebody wants me to, but I don't think they should do it at all. The end.
I think this is a really necessary hunt. Both the Henrys and the Ponts are going to have a ton of this kind of buck. And so it is, I do wish you could think of a little, because you couldn't even say like live velvet, because some of the cactus bucks shed. I know a lot of people have found cactus buck sheds down the Henrys. It's not like, I don't know, it's hard to classify any other way. I think it's necessary though, and I think to avoid prosecution issues, you couldn't say like just a certain amount of velvet. You'd have to just velvet and hope that there's not too many issues with bucks, trophy bucks, having just a little bit attached still.
Can I say, yeah. So that's part of the mandatory check-in. We'll see every one of these deer, and we'll know if we have a problem and if we need to readjust. And I think that's why that's in there, is because we wanted to have that security and know exactly what was being harvested, if the hunt was meeting the intent.
Okay. Do we still want to make a motion on it?
I'll withdraw that motion. I can see the can of worms it's going to create to try and do something that you can't prosecute.
But I will, you know.
Going off the fact that they will be seeing every deer that comes through and be able to evaluate it, it's 1 year. I'd make a motion that we pass it with reevaluation based off the DWR's results from the check-ins.
Okay, so.
I think you just let it go with the plan.
Just let it go with the plan is what you're saying.
Don't need a motion.
Exactly.
Do we have any motion, any other motions?
I make a motion. We accept it with the exception of the minimum draw weight and minimum arrow weight, that be left as current.
Okay. I'll second.
Okay, so we have a motion by Eric Luke, seconded by Helene Taylor, to accept the plan as recommended, excluding or leaving the draw weight at 40 pounds. Something in that realm. Okay. All for it? Okay. 9. Opposed? Yep, Darryl Meekum opposed. All right. Removal of wild mule deer from domesticated elk facilities. Doing really good. Our goal is to beat every other rack as far as length of time. What do we got? How are we doing?
Okay. This is a new rule that we're proposing here. So a little bit of the background. Domesticated elk are managed and regulated by the Utah Department of Agriculture. They're not managed by the Division of Wildlife. Occasionally, we have wild deer that get into these facilities, into the domesticated elk holding facilities. These deer aren't available to the hunting public and pose disease risks to other wild populations and domesticated elk. So I think it's important here to recognize that the domesticated elk operators are worried about their animals, and we're worried about the animals that could possibly get back out into the wild. So domesticated elk operators in the division need additional tools to remove wild deer from these facilities. Currently in code, the responsibility for removing these animals falls on the division. And it's tough. It's tough if we don't have somebody there all the time to be able to address this, and it's impractical. This tool will help with that. What we propose is a certificate of registration. So this rule allows for a COR for lethal removal of wild deer within domesticated elk facilities. An owner, operator of the domesticated elk facility that locates wild deer within the boundary must immediately notify the division. Upon confirmation, the owner or operator may apply for a COR authorizing the lethal removal of deer. There's some terms. The terms of the COR: only the owner or operator, their immediate family members, or facility employees may be authorized to lethally remove deer. The division will regulate quite a bit here. In fact, they regulate dates authorized for removal, number of deer authorized for removal, and directions to the COR holder regarding carcass delivery to the division for donation and disease sampling. The terms continued. The COR authorizes lethal removal of wild deer within the perimeter of the facility fence, and no fee may be assessed by the COR holder. And what we're trying to prevent, and we worked with the domesticated elk facility operators on this, and that is, this is not a hunt. It's a tool, and we all recognize that, and we want to prevent it from becoming a hunt. The recording requirements and disease testing: any deer removed from the facility must promptly be provided to the division, and the COR holder may not keep any part of the deer, including antlers or meat. The COR holder must deliver each carcass to the division in condition allowing for meat donation and disease sampling. And then the reservation of authority. There may be situations that we choose to handle differently. A large breach or something like that where the animals haven't commingled. We may choose to work to get those animals out of the facility. And so this stays in the rule and that allows the division to make those choices and determinations. With that, thank you.
Okay. Questions from the rack?
I have a question as to, so if these deer are getting inside a fence,
yes.
Aren't there elk getting out?
The deer seem to be little Houdinis. And truthfully, these operators work hard to keep their fences up. This program recently has had a new coordinator appointed, and she's working hard. The program's in really good shape right now over at the Department of Ag. Leslie McFarland, that used to work for us, went and took that position over there. And every year, we go with the Department of Ag to make sure these fences are in good condition. So practical application is we would go out with the Department of Ag, walk the fences, make sure they're good, and then have the discussion with the operator. Do you have deer in there? Yeah, I've got some deer. Okay, let's look at issuing you a COR to remove those animals. We know your fences are good, they're tight, and that's the practical application of how it would work.
Okay.
Does the division are going to confirm the deer actually exist there, or are you just taking somebody's word for it?
We would work with the operator to confirm that the deer are there. And it can be difficult, and that's part of the reason why the division isn't removing all these animals. We'd have to be there a lot during different times of the year, and really it's a poor use of sportsman's dollars to have us there all the time doing that. So we'll work with the operator to confirm, but if they aren't there, you can't shoot anything, I guess. So that's the other part of it.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? We do have a comment. Okay. So, Kelly, we have a comment from the audience. Kelly Hymas, Utah Elk Breeders and Hunting Parks.
This is Kelly Hymas with the Utah Elk Breeders Association and the Hunting Park owners. We are in support of this. It will be a much more efficient way to remove the animals. We're concerned about disease. This offers us an opportunity to get rid of the animals without having to schedule a day to come in, and then they're not where we found them the last time, and it just works much more easier and slicker, and it removes the financial burden from the division. It puts the burden on us to get it to them in a proper manner, so we support that. Thank you.
I knew you looked familiar. Okay. Comments from the rack. If I can make a quick comment, I was on this board with Covey, with the domesticated elk, and or I still am, and they're working really hard to mitigate any issues that have occurred in the past. And I know that they're checking fences, and I don't think we're going to have the issues that we've had in the past. So Leslie is doing a great job. Okay, do we have a motion?
I move we accept the division's recommendations
as outlined.
Okay, so we have a recommendation or a motion from Kirk Player to accept the division's recommendations. A second? Darren Olson? All in favor? Unanimous.
Passed. Thank you.
Statewide pronghorn management plan. Randy. There is a lot of goats right now. Oh my gosh. Between, it's nuts.
Okay, thank you. My name is Randy Larson. I'm an associate professor at BYU doing a one-year sabbatical leave with the Division of Wildlife Resources. So thanks for your time. I'm sort of here getting a real education, you might say. I've traded Cougar Blue for Division Brown. Based on the way the football team's playing, was a good timing. I'm here to present the statewide pronghorn plan, seek input from the public as well as the RAC. We'll move relatively quickly through most of it, except for one big change that we are proposing where we'll spend a little bit of time. So our current pronghorn plan is expiring, and we're proposing a new plan as a 10-year plan. We did not form an official committee, but we did seek input from a variety of stakeholders, and we're here today seeking additional input as part of the public process. Like most plans, permit numbers and recommendations would be made in accordance with this plan, and this plan would provide guidance to how we manage pronghorn in the state of Utah. The plan has a population management goal. We don't have a population objective in the plan, and I'll speak to that in a minute, but we have a goal of managing pronghorn to population objectives and within carrying capacity of available habitats. Currently in the state of Utah, only a few of our pronghorn units have individual unit plans. This plan, we're now proposing that we develop individual unit plans for the units that don't by the end of 2018, and that once that process is complete, the statewide population objective would simply be the sum of those individual unit objectives. We want to increase pronghorn where we can within the state as conditions allow, manage populations to their unit objectives. We'd also are proposing to augment or reintroduce pronghorn in several areas. And then there are certainly some concerns in some regions with depredation, and so we're proposing doe harvest and transplants in those areas where needed. Mm-hmm. In green there on the right, you can see where we currently have pronghorn in the state of Utah. The kind of yellow-orange polygons on that map are areas where we are proposing to release pronghorn at some point in the next 10 years. Those would be typically an augmentation of herds that are struggling, or in one case, a reintroduction where pronghorn historically occurred but don't currently exist. We want to conserve and improve pronghorn habitat throughout the state. The state has two large initiatives, the Watershed Restoration Initiative that focuses on habitat restoration, habitat improvement, and a new Wildlife Migration Initiative. The plan asks for collaboration with those two initiatives to help pronghorn. We're also proposing to develop and implement a maintenance schedule related to water development, guzzlers. Water is an important part of pronghorn habitat and an important part of what they need. We want to provide opportunities to hunt and view pronghorn, increase hunting opportunities using a variety of strategies. The biggest change is right here, and so currently we manage pronghorn populations to a buck-doe ratio. We're proposing in this plan to change the way we manage pronghorn from that buck-doe ratio to an age objective. And there's a couple reasons why I'll show you here in a minute, but we're proposing to manage to an average age between 2 and 3 years old. And then, of course, we'd use archery and muzzleloader hunts to distribute pressure and provide additional hunting opportunities. We'll spend a minute here just making sure everybody understands this graph. We currently don't collect teeth and age pronghorn in Utah, but we did in 2008 and 2009. And so on the x-axis there on the bottom, those are the years or the age of animals that were harvested by hunters in either 2008 or 2009. On the y-axis is the average horn length as measured and reported by hunters as part of a post-harvest survey. A couple things to point out. Pronghorn are completely different than deer and elk in that they reach maximum horn size at a very early age, often by 3 years of age. If you look there, at the two-year-olds, the longest horns from a harvested animal in 2008 or 2009 was a two-year-old. If you look in the Boone and Crockett record books, a big bunch of the top entries are two-year-olds. You can see the top end, you know, there's a whole bunch of them at two and three. And so managing to an older age class doesn't make a lot of sense. The other thing that happens with pronghorn is adult survival of even the bucks is not, it's a little lower than typically you'd see in a deer or elk. So maybe only 80% survive outside of hunting. And so you're losing 20% to non-harvest mortality each year. With this species anyways, it doesn't seem to make much sense to target an older age class. When these data were collected in 2008 and 2009, the average age was almost 4. It was 3.7. And so we think that we can provide a little bit more opportunity, some more permits, shift the age structure down a little bit and not compromise quality or, you know, trophy quality of those hunts. So in our view, as an agency, it's kind of a win-win, and that's why we're proposing this change to an age-based management strategy. Finish up here quickly. Pronghorn are unique in North America. They're an important part of our natural heritage. We'd like to highlight them as a species, use social media, work with the media, etc. And in summary, this plan would be the statewide plan. Unit plans would roll out by the end of 2018. And we're proposing this one big change from the previous plan to age-based management. I want to thank you for all you do and all your time and energy in this process.
Thank you. Questions from the rec?
I have a question, Randy. How much, with the change, how much more opportunity, how many more tags do you anticipate statewide?
Sure, great question. It's a little tough to say. We're about a decade removed from when we have those age data, but back then the average age was 3.7. If it's similar to that now, we would anticipate just back of the napkin calculations that you'd be adding 80 to 100 permits. We currently give out 750 or so on average last few years. Maybe we can add 100 to that. It would depend a lot on lots of issues, you know, from the different regions, crowding, and those types of things. But we think, you know, if we shift that age down to like 2.7 on average for the state a whole year, you're probably talking close to 100 permits.
Any other questions?
I have a question. It wasn't really specifically addressed in this, but Tricia hit on it a minute ago. At least out in this end of the state, pronghorn populations are up. And I, you know, we're noticing that as we go out and about, we see a lot more of them. Is the division planning on letting the populations grow and continuing that and where they're living? Or are they going to start doe hunts and stuff to knock them back? Or are we planning on letting them get bigger?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's kind of a mixed bag in Utah. The western half of Utah, we're worried about them struggling a bit. This statewide plan, we're calling for individual unit plans to be developed by the end of 2018. And so at that part of the process, objectives will be set for each unit relative to all the concerns associated with the units. And so then you would sort of see where you're at. Are you below or above objective based on that individual unit plan process, if that makes sense?
Okay.
Why a 10-year plan versus a 5-year plan like deer and elk?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I have a great answer for that. The plan would certainly be subject to changes or amendments during that 10-year process, and so nothing would be set in stone. The sense was, you know, maybe not all that much changes in the pronghorn management world, and let's not require a bunch of time from people to form committees and make changes every 5 years. Maybe we can push it out to 10. But you know, it certainly could change during that 10-year window with an amendment process, no problem.
One last question. Would the division be open to a boundary change on the North Santa Fe to include the area west of SR-10? I see more and more antelope on the other side of the road there that
Available to others. Let's seek some regional help on that. I'm not super familiar with that issue. Someone want to, from the region, want to?
You have to repeat the question. We were having a conversation, so don't ask me again.
Would the division be open to a boundary change for the North Santa Fe unit to include that area west of SR-10? Seeing more and more antelope on that side of the road, and it's outside the boundary to where they're not available to hunters.
Yeah, I think we'd look at it to try and see if we could come up with a boundary for that. I Wade's not here, but I think we've looked at that before, and there's just where to put that boundary, where, you know, how far to go and what we can use for landmarks or whatever to change that, but I think we can look at it.
Thank you. Okay. All right, so I'm going to go to questions from the audience. Comments from the audience. Okay, so back to the rack. Comments or motions?
I move that we accept the division's recommendations as outlined.
Do I have a second on that? Okay, so Kirk Player, a motion to accept the recommendations as outlined and seconded by Daryl Meekum. All in favor?
Be open to an amendment to that?
Back up. Do you want to add? Yeah, we're open to amend if that's okay.
You be open to amending it to make that boundary change on that North Santa Fe to include that west side of the highway?
Should we do that with it or separate?
You'd have to actually do this prior to.
Yeah,
okay. It's got to be first.
Yeah, do yours.
I'm going to have to.
Do yours first.
Withdraw your motion.
Withdraw your motion.
I withdraw my motion.
Okay.
I think that the time to do that was passed with the boundaries that we set forth earlier. So we already approved those boundaries just a few minutes ago.
This is just what this rack is for, is the boundaries?
At the appropriate time. This is just a statewide plan. We're just approving the statewide plan, so there's nothing that was in this presentation that talked about any of the boundaries.
Okay.
I put my motion back in.
Okay. Second it.
And then Daryl is seconding it. Daryl. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Okay. So now we have the statewide moose management plan by Kent.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So tonight I'm presenting the updated statewide management plan for moose in Utah. So like pronghorn, this plan provides overall guidance for managing Utah's moose populations. We're going to look at this plan again in 10 years and see if anything needs updated and changed during that time period. And then all moose recommendations will be made in accordance with this plan. So we have three goals like pronghorn. We have the population, habitat, and recreation goals. To start off with our population, we want to achieve optimum populations of moose in all suitable habitat within the state. And then we want an objective to increase the moose populations within the state as these conditions allow. And we want to make sure to maintain these populations at the appropriate objectives to prevent population declines. So when we look at population data for moose in Utah, moose were actually not present at the time of settlement. They started coming in the early 1900s onto that north slope of the Uintas area mainly, and we considered it, the population established around 1950. Since that time, moose have done quite well. They grew and they peaked in around 93 or so. That was followed by a population crash. We then grew moose again to the mid-2000s and followed by a second crash. So I think what's pretty evident from this graph is that, that habitat is clearly limiting moose in Utah. We are at the extreme southern end of the range, and so basically moose cannot just grow on forever. We do need to manage them appropriately and prevent this population crash cycle that we've been in here. So with that, our population strategies, first off, we want to update our unit management plans and make sure our objectives in those plans are appropriate. Survey these units every 3 years so that we know how many we have. And then we also want to get more aggressive with antlerless harvest and make sure we're controlling these populations at the appropriate level to prevent crashes. And along with that, we want to use transplants to help bolster existing populations that are struggling, but then also use that to lower densities where needed. So with transplants, the green shows the rough distribution of moose in Utah, with most of the southern end of that being relatively small populations. And so what we want to do is take a more concerted effort to start populations at that southern end, in particular on the Nebo and a bunch of sites on the Manti and the Fish Lake. We also have moose moving over from the Aviniquin area onto the Tavaputs Plateau, so we want to put some moose there and help get that established. And then, interestingly, we have moose coming down from Idaho up into the Raft Rivers and the Grouse Creek Mountains, and so we think we can start helping that population as well. Those would all be augmentations. The one new population we're looking at would be on the Tusher Mountains. It has some good high elevation willow bottoms, about 10,000 feet or so, similar to some stuff they were successful with in Colorado in the Grand Mesa area, and we think we can establish a population there. So for habitat, we want to assure sufficient habitat is available to sustain healthy moose populations with the objective of maintaining or enhancing the quantity and quality of habitat to allow these herds to reach objective. So for strategies, we want to make sure we're identifying the crucial habitats and work to protect and enhance these areas, minimize or mitigate the loss or degradation of this habitat, identify potential migratory routes or barriers to moose. Biggest ones that we're looking at there would be things like I-80, I-84 up north, where we have a lot of moose vehicle collisions. And we also want to have a bunch of prescribed burning and timber harvest, creating early successional habitats, which is what moose need to thrive, and then maintain populations at the appropriate density to prevent any habitat damage. And then lastly, with our recreation side, we're looking at both opportunities for hunting and for viewing moose. For the hunting objective, we want to increase hunting opportunities as populations allow, but we want to also maintain a quality hunting experience as this is a once-in-a-lifetime species. And then we also want to increase viewing opportunities for moose and educate the public about moose in Utah and the needs of them. So for the hunting objective, the biggest change from this plan is that we're proposing lowering the age objective down to a 4-year-old harvested moose with a range of 3.75 to 4.25. Last plan called for managing for 4 to 6, and that was the first time we looked at using age to manage moose in Utah. And I'll give some data on the next slides here, but we think we set that a little too high to start off. So the other objectives before I get into the data, we want to have subunits to put make sure we're maximizing hunting opportunities and distributing hunters where we need them, and also have long hunting seasons to provide a good opportunity. So with harvest in Utah, it tracks very closely with population trend, and you'll also see that you know, these lines are very close to overlapping, which means we have extremely high hunter success. We average about 97% for bulls in Utah, which is the highest of any western state. So we think we have some opportunity here to increase tags and not have to run 100% success on all these hunts. And then when we look at our age data, this is age of harvested moose with spread. as the y-axis variable, and this is data back from 1986 through 2015. And so when we initially looked at this, we wanted to go 4 to 6 to try and hit that very top part of the curve. But what we found is that that range was too big, first off. And so on units where we could increase opportunity, it wasn't exceeding 6, so we actually didn't have that ability. Moreover, we actually found from collaring moose that we were actually losing a lot of moose at 5, 6, 7 years old due to natural mortality. So we were really just wasting the resource, and by trying to get these older age classes, we weren't even hitting 5, yet we were losing a lot of opportunity. So we think if we knock this back to 4, we're still at one of the higher parts on this curve, but can provide additional opportunity and not sacrifice much quality. And then lastly, with the viewing objective, we want to use more social media and other news media sources to inform and educate about moose and moose management that we do. One thing that's becoming more prevalent is working with the local communities to reduce moose conflicts, especially as these urban areas continue to expand. And then also use data from our wildlife migration initiative to generate interest and support for moose. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the RAC? Okay. Do you have any questions from the audience? No comments, right? Okay. Do I have any comments and or motions from the RAC?
I would make a motion to approve the Division's recommendations on the statewide management plan for moose.
Yep. Recommendation from Kent Johnson to accept the management plan as proposed, seconded by Kirk Player. All in favor? Unanimous. Passed. Okay. Your management plan by Jim Christensen. Northern region.
Thank you. I'm going to be presenting the management plans for the mule deer on 7 of the northern region deer units. These will be units 1 through 7. We do also manage unit 8A, but it went. Its deer plan went through the public process last year. So I'll just be presenting units 1 through 7. These management plans, they're almost identical to one another with the exception of varying population objectives and buck to doe objectives. And so I will touch on each of those individually. All the objectives and strategies that I will discuss tonight all fall under accordance of the statewide mule deer plan. So with our unit population objectives, we are proposing no changes across the region. Three of our units are currently over population objective. This past winter we did suffer significant fawn loss in the tune of 50% to 90%. Across the region, and so we are anticipating population reductions across the region, and so we will continue to manage the overall population size with antlerless harvest as needed, and again we'll determine those numbers after we recalculate our population estimate for this year, and then we did not choose to increase population objectives due to increasing agricultural depredation and then increased habitat use and increased habitat loss as well. Our buck to doe objectives, units 1 and 2 are our public lands units. The remaining 5 are mainly private lands units. So our public lands units are our opportunity units at 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does, the remainder at 18 to 20 with no change in comparison to the previous plan. We will continue to work through private lands challenges to increase more bucks to bring our buck to doe ratios back down towards objective. We are anticipating some reductions in our buck to doe ratios similar to the overall population size. And so once we finish up our postseason classifications this year and look at our three-year average, we'll determine permits accordingly coming up here in January, February timeframe. So across the region, we have several different challenges, but also some opportunities that arise with having mainly private lands units. Across the region, we're approximately 75% private land ownership, with one of our units has 96% private land across the unit. So one of the challenges is having access for hunters, but one of the opportunities is the CWMU program. Currently, we have 75 different CWMUs across the region. That opens up access to general public, and it also provides an incentive to private landowners, a financial incentive, to provide mule deer habitat and to provide for higher tolerance of mule deer on their property. Again, with private lands, there's other private landowners who are not as tolerant to the deer numbers, and so we experience significant amount of agricultural depredation to those landowners, and so we'll continue to work with them to get them enrolled in the appropriate programs to best suit their needs and to best help them out. Again, with private lands, we have a significant amount of development in both winter and summer range, and so we'll continue to address those issues as they arise. One of the challenges that we face with depredation or with development is we will have agricultural fields circled by homes, and it removes some of the tools from our toolbox that we've traditionally been able to use. And so again, we'll look into our toolbox and use the appropriate program to fit the need. We are not unlike other regions across the state. We are not. We have our concerns with disease across the region, so we will continue our surveillance program for chronic wasting disease, as well as sampling any other suspect animal. Again, we have roadkill issues like everywhere else, so we'll continue to work with UDOT and our migration initiative coordinator to identify appropriate locations for highway fencing, underpasses, overpasses, etc. And then with predation, we have the Mule Deer Protection Act in place to help reduce the number of coyote on the landscape, and then we'll work directly with wildlife services to target coyotes on mule deer fawning areas on units 1 and 2 to try and bolster the population in those two units. Habitat across the northern region, with our 5-year range trend assessment that occurred in 2016, are one of the indexes that are recorded is a desired components index, which measures various aspects of the habitat that are desirable for mule deer. That DCI score across the region declined for every one of our units, mainly due to the understory vegetation. We still have good overstory shrub component, but the understory is being lost to bulbous bluegrass and cheatgrass mainly. And so with that, we will continue to do annual spring range assessments with our habitat section. We'll target specific areas where the mule deer spent the winter and look at habitat use in those areas and be able to assess the potential for habitat projects and improvements. Some of our challenges are, again, the changing in the understory. If we try and be proactive to reduce those grasses in the understory, we risk removing our overstory vegetation, hurting our winter ranges, and so that presents a big challenge for us. The other challenge is implementing habitat improvement projects on the private lands that will be beneficial to mule deer. So we are currently proposing projects, and we will continue to propose habitat improvement projects through the Watershed Restoration Initiative. So in summary, we are looking at a potential increase in antlerless harvests on 3 of our units, increased buck harvests on 5 of our units, continued improvement in the habitat, and continue to work with the issues that are associated with private lands and try to provide opportunities for both the private landowners as well as the sportsmen and the mule deer. With that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you.
One question. Has the division explored ideas about transplanting does on units that are way over objective into places where we're chronically under objective?
The problem with that is the private lands issues, and a lot of those landowners in those units that are chronically over objective, the private landowners want the mule deer up there because the majority of the area is enrolled in CWMU program, and so they have a financial incentive to have more deer on the area. And so that's one of our challenges, is it being able to harvest enough deer, because we're at the will of the private landowners allowing access. And so we could issue 1,000 tags. We could try and, you know, propose to move deer, but for example the Chalk Creek unit, where we're 96% private land, getting access to those lands and to those deer is difficult.
Okay. Question. On those, like the Chalk Creek and those units that have a much higher buck-to-doe ratio than objective, do you have any data that shows what the fawn survival rate is on those units compared to the others?
Yeah, so on those units, the last couple of years we've had better fawn survival. We figure we had around a 50% fawn survival on the Chalk Creek this past winter, whereas on the Cache, we only had 10% fawn survival.
Okay, any other questions from the rack? Any questions from the audience? Do you have any comments from the audience? So back to the rack for comments and or motions.
I'll make a motion to approve the Northern Region Deer Management Plan as outlined.
We have a recommendation from Todd Thorne.
I'll second it.
And seconded by Eric Luke. All in favor? And passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I believe, because we skipped that one, right? EWMUs? By Mike.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Mike Wardle. I'm the new Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the state of Utah. I came to this position from the southern region, where I worked as a landowner specialist, working with landowners that had conflict with wildlife. I'll be presenting on the 2018 CWMU Buck and Bull recommendations. Given the hour, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll probably hurry through other regions, but highlight some of the stuff here in the southeastern region.
That sounds like a great idea.
Just a brief introduction. The CWMU program stands for Cooperative Wildlife Management Unit, and it's a program aimed at incentivizing landowners to manage their property for wildlife use. Jim touched on some of the issues we have in the northern region with private lands, and this we found this program to be very effective in helping us build partnerships with those landowners. Statewide, we have 125 CWMUs, again, the majority of which are in the northern region, with 75 of them. Here in the southeastern region, we have 18. The part of the slide I want to point out is the point that says more than 2.2 million acres are enrolled. That's a lot of land, and it's a lot of land that is good for wildlife. It is a lot of land that has been open to the public because of this CWMU program. So you'll see in this table, the left side has the species, the middle section shows the number of permits that we're recommending go to the CWMU operators, and then on the right side goes to the public. Again, the point I want to make is that in the bottom right-hand corner, 505 public permits, and that's 505 people who will be able to hunt on these private lands that otherwise would not get that opportunity. So we've received one application for a new CWMU. This is a big year for renewals. CWMUs operate on a 3-year certificate of registration, and again, we have a lot of them renewing this year. Of those 85 CWMUs, we're recommending approving 84 and recommend denying one CWMU. We had one that submitted a change application, and a total of 87 applications were submitted. So before I get into the regional recommendations, you're going to see the changes. I've highlighted where we're increasing permits and where we're decreasing permits, and I just want to briefly touch on some of the reasoning behind that. So when we increase permits in a CWMU, for one thing, we're increasing public opportunity on that private land. Another big reason is acreage change. If a CWMU adds acres to their unit, a lot of times there's opportunity there that we can take advantage of. Again, habitat quality or distribution of animals. Animals move, and sometimes the distribution changes, and it allows us to increase permits or decrease. Unit management goals and objectives. Again, these are a cooperative effort between us and a landowner, and sometimes we increase or decrease permits to bring management in line with our goals and objectives. Some reasons to decrease. One of the ones I'll highlight is population decline. Jim touched on a hard winter there in the northern region, and you'll see some of that reflected as well. So we'll go through the regions. In the northern region, that was where the new application was. That was for Rosette. It's in the northwestern part of the state. They have 5,300 acres, and we recommend approving that CWMU. So as I go through these, I'll just throw the slide up there. If you have questions, we can come back to them. This is for the northern region. Again, you'll see the increases are highlighted in green, decreases are highlighted in red. And then if we're adding a species to a CWMU, that is blue. These are for the southern region and the central region. So here in the southeastern region, we're recommending an increase in deer on the Deerhaven CWMU, an increase in elk on the Hiawatha, an increase in deer and elk on the Indian Head, and an increase in deer in Patmos Ridge. The one I want to highlight is Jump Creek. That is the CWMU that we're recommending denying. Jump Creek was given a variance by the Wildlife Board 3 years ago to operate. They didn't qualify for the acres. They didn't have the acres to qualify for a CWMU, but the Wildlife Board gave them a variance, and with the requirement that they got up to acreage. And they were not able to do that in the last 3 years, so we recommend denying that renewal application. Schofield Canyons, we recommend a decrease in elk permits. And at Summit Point, we recommend a decrease in elk permits. And then Schofield West, we recommend an increase in elk and Soldier Summit, and Spring Creek and Dodge, an increase in deer. And then Black Hawk, an increase in elk. Here's for the northeastern region. And then we have two turkey CWMUs as well. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. Do we have questions for Mike from the RAC?
I have one question. So Black Hawk and Hiawatha are both on the Manti unit. We raised the regular limited entry tags for the unit, and also increasing both of those CWMU tags. What's the numbers behind that as far as why they're able to increase? Like the unit's pretty over-hunted.
Okay. So maybe that's a better be better answered by the region.
In both cases, they just increased acreage, and the permit numbers are calculated based on the acreage they have on the CWMU, the proportion of the total. So, yeah, when you add acreage, it allows for some.
So will that reflect back? This might be a little bit off. Will that reflect back onto the regular limited entry tags? Would that decrease from them because it's the same elk, essentially?
Yeah, when we write an elk recommendation, it's the total number of dead bull elk we can have on the Manti, which includes CWMUs. It's all the same pie there. Okay. So, yeah, theoretically it could. You know, it could take one away from a public. Typically we don't do that. These are private land that we didn't have access to anyway. Typically we add a tag there. But what we try to calculate it on is based on, you know, the total number of dead bull elk we can have on the mountain.
Thank you.
Not on the mountain.
I have a question. When the elk are aged and classified, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess my question is, the CWMUs are put in right with the public land. So when you look at the age classifications, are the CWMUs looked at separately from the public permits, or are they the same?
When we do the average age for the unit, they're included, and they tend to be higher, on the Manti especially, but it's such a small proportion of the total that it usually changes the overall number by less than a tenth of a year.
And how are the overall numbers looked at when you look at population objectives?
How do you mean, I guess?
Well, so on a unit, Manti, for instance, you have so many 12,000 elk. Does that include the...
The private lands.
And public lands?
Yep. That it includes all the private lands as well. We have some units in the state that are virtually all private land, and we have a population objective on those as well.
Okay, thanks.
Any more questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience? Do you have any comments? Okay, comments and or motions from the RAC?
I have a comment. One of my concerns, I think I've seen it over the years with the CWMUs, they are gaining more elk year after year. The landowners are seeing the, they're keeping the elk there. They quit hunting them during the hunts when public is pushing them, and so more and more elk seem to move on to those private lands and stay there. And so that means less elk that are available to the public. And I'm not sure how it's thought of as far as numbers and population objectives, but it seems like those should be separated.
I know if I remember when they lowered cow tags last year, tell me if I'm wrong, I can't remember, but I think there was 13,000 cow tags, and we pushed a bunch of them over to private lands, and the goal they stated was to, kill more elk there, hopefully push them off. But I don't know if somebody wanted to, that was just my fuzzy memory of it.
I think that was mostly up on the Wasatch.
It was, yeah, it's up in the northern region. I flap my gums long enough about CWMU, so I try to stay quiet.
I think, kind of going off what Eric said, that so that's to aid the private landowners and the public to get rid of those elk. That was more cow only. I think what he's saying is more CWMUs that are operating in areas that have limited entry or any bull hunts, they intentionally don't hunt during the time that the general public can. So it makes a refuge there.
Sure.
They're helping themselves. One concern I have is I've heard from a lot of people, I've never personally hunted a CWMU, but a lot of people have talked to me saying that they're not satisfied with the operator, the amount, the time frame that they give them, because they can allot them, I think, a minimum of 5 days, but it's a 5 days that right after they've hunted or something, and they can also walk, prevent the public tags from hunting. I believe it's 10% of their property. And so they can kind of corral them to certain areas where they know the hunting isn't as good. And I think that that's a bit of a concern, just because they can control that and make their property a refuge. And
that's. Some of the operators are really good and really cordial to the public hunters, and others are not so much.
You fix that.
I don't know. It's, even if you put laws in place, it would be very difficult to enforce them.
I don't know if this would be the time, but and just if it's not, then it's not. But would that be something that the RAC could put a recommendation up that the board look at, maybe aligning season dates so they've got to hunt them when we've got to hunt them?
So can I make a comment real quick? Just so everybody's aware, there is what's called a CWMU Advisory Committee. That looks at those kinds of issues. If a public hunter has a complaint, that complaint is filed, and then that CWMU is brought before that advisory committee. So there is a method for solving those problems, just so you're aware.
In addition to that, I should say that this concern was brought up, and we heard it, and also you have a lot of good operators out there. They heard it too. And there's a big concern among a lot of the operators that they don't want their names tarnished. They don't want... This program has several benefits. It's not just public opportunity on private lands. It's holding wildlife habitat, keeping it as wildlife habitat. It's allowing elk in areas before where we couldn't have elk. It's changed how we manage wildlife. And when the operators heard, hey, we have other operators that aren't treating the public correctly, they came to us and said, all right, we would like to do a training 3 times a year in conjunction with the division and make it mandatory that all the operators have to go to that training. And we currently do that. We did it last year, and we did it again this year. And what we've noticed is the division, sure, we work to hold CWMUs and operators accountable, but their peers hold them a lot more accountable. And this training is working, and we're seeing improvements, and we're seeing changes in attitude. And I think that's important for the RAC to know that there are some things in place that we are doing, trainings and the advisory committee to work with operators to make this program better. Yep. Kobe Jones, I should say that, I guess. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have...
A motion that we accept their CWMU plans and as suggested.
As presented? Okay, great. So we have Jay Skyman motions to accept the plan as recommended. A second on that?
I'll second it.
So Todd Thorne, second. All in favor? And it passes unanimously.
All right, me again. So I'll also be presenting our recommendations for 2018 Landowner Association vouchers. Now the Landowner Association program is a little different than CWMU. CWMU requires, you know, a large amount of acres. Landowner associations can be made up of a diverse group of landowners with, you know, big chunks of land, small chunks of land, and also these permits are good for an entire unit instead of just their private property. So we have 17 total landowner associations, or LOAs, throughout the state. Again, they operate on a 3-year COR, similar to the CWMU program, and this is a big year for renewal requests. Two of the landowner associations were already approved. We haven't had a request for any new LOAs, but we have had 15 landowner association renewal requests. So in this slide, the first section talks about the number of vouchers that have been requested, and then the second section talks about what we are recommending. And you'll notice there's a discrepancy in the numbers. And the reason behind that is that the LOAs are, what's the word I'm looking for? They qualify for a certain number of vouchers according to how many acres they have. And our recommendations are in line with those qualifications, and sometimes the requests are not. And so that's why that discrepancy exists. So you'll see we have a request for 117 buck deer vouchers, 4 management buck deer, 80 elk vouchers, and 9 pronghorn vouchers. But the division is recommending 109 buck deer vouchers, 1 management buck deer, 71 elk vouchers, and 8 pronghorn vouchers. Now these next two tables will show the landowner associations where the recommended, requested, and qualified vouchers are all in accordance with each other. So you'll see in these tables, on the left side has the LOA name, the middle column shows the species, and then the right column shows the number of vouchers that they qualify for, they've requested, and we're recommending. And that's also the same with this slide as well. Now this final slide shows the split recommendations. So again, these are landowner associations where they've requested an amount of vouchers that is different from what they qualify for, and our recommendation is what they qualify for according to the rule. So for Book Cliffs Elk, they've requested 9. They qualify for 3, and we are recommending 3. For Book Cliffs Pronghorn, they've requested 3. They qualify for 2, and we are recommending 2. For Panguitch Lake Elk, they've requested 7. They qualify for 5, and we are recommending 5. For Paunsagaunt Management Deer, they've requested 4. They qualify for 1, and we are recommending 1. For Three Corners Elk, they have requested 5. They qualify for 4, and we are recommending 4. And for Vernon Deer, they have requested 36. They qualify for 28, and we are recommending 28. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay. So do we have any questions from the RAC? Okay. Questions from the audience? We do have a comment from the audience. Mark Hill, Cliff Landowner Association.
Hello, my name is Mark Hill, and my wife and I currently own a commercial cow-calf operation along with a commercial sheep operation. We own property on the south side and the north side of the Book Cliffs, and we're members of the Book Cliffs Landowner Association, and I am the president at this time. We recently learned that the division is recommending that they cut the number of bull elk and pronghorn tags that a landowner association receives. As a member of that, the Book Cliff Landowner Association, I disagree with this recommendation. On our ranch alone this summer, we spent over $40,000 hauling water for our cows during the drought, and at the same time, the elk and deer we're drinking out of our water tanks and our ponds, as well as 40 and 50 head of bison every day. So we're currently in the process of pumping water from our water rights off our private property, putting pipelines in on federal ground, which will benefit for the elk, the deer, as well as our livestock in areas where there isn't any water. We have several hundred acres of irrigated ground in the Book Cliffs, and in the summer months, the most critical times of the growing season, we have up to 300 head of elk sleeping and urinating in our hay crops. And what they don't eat, they urinate on, and our cows won't eat it when we harvest it. And in addition to this, we're now discovering that our livestock are competing with large herds of bison. And the bison, the damages they do is ridiculous. They chase the cows off our water that we haul. They have no respect for the fences, and they're tearing them up constantly. So now we have substantial damages from other species, which we know we won't be compensated for the division is wanting to cut our elk vouchers. And if that happens, we'll receive no compensation for more damages than we have now. At least now the income received from the vouchers helps us offset some of the costs. We're almost a 30-year-old association, and we've had the same amount of tags all these years. In the past, the association was made up of ranchers that had large chunks of private property. Now the association is made up of smaller landowners and oil companies. The allocation of the current tags is spread over more landowners, which limits compensation for some of the landowners that suffer the most damages. In the future, our landowner vouchers reduced will be forced to review our legal options to recover damages from the DW or the DNR. So I'm asking someone from the RAC to make a motion to leave the tags as they have been in the past for the last 30 years. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Mark, what unit are you on?
Bookcliffs.
Bookcliffs, which one?
We're the north. And south. It's the same, isn't it?
As far as elk, yeah.
So, elk,
it's the Bitter Creek for the elk and the deer. It's north.
So, what did you have, and what are they giving you now, or what are they proposing?
We've had 9 tags. They have since the early 90s, before I was here, and they're trying to take them and give us 3.
This is the elk, right?
Yes, sir. And then they're trying to cut our antelope from 3 to 2. And we got way more antelope than we've had in the last 15 years, so.
Could the division answer the question as to why? Especially with the antelope, I know the numbers are way up. I work out there, I'm out there all the time, I see them.
Yeah, so if the region wants to speak to specifics, they're welcome to. What I can say is that these recommendations come from a percentage of how much habitat exists within the landowner association compared to the entire unit.
So did they have members of the association leave? Did that happen, Mark? Did somebody bail out on you, or what happened?
3 years ago, Mustang Fuels pulled out. They're the largest landowner in the association. They had 20-some thousand acres in an oil company. But 3 years ago, when we addressed this issue, the biologist admitted at the meeting in Salt Lake where they voted on it, and they said that even if they pulled out, we didn't lose any habitat. They're in a CWMU now, and all they get is deer tags. They don't even get any elk tags. So they pretty much admitted that we didn't lose any habitat.
Yeah, I remember the conversation. I was here then. I remember that conversation.
We lost 20,000 acres, but we didn't lose any elk habitat. That was the biologist's words at the Salt Lake meeting.
Yeah, I remember that now. I remember that conversation.
I have a question. I realize this comment period, but it brings up some clarification. So if they lost the land 3 years ago, is there some reason that the tags were not adjusted then and they are being adjusted now?
I think my assumption is just because it's a 3-year certificate of registration that these...
I was here then, and I can speak to that again. Kobe Jones. We did recommend reducing the permits then. And I think the important thing, Mark, is I understand what you're saying. However, that 22,000 acres is included. So when we look at allocating these permits, it's the percent of land within the unit and then the percent of total permits. And it's important to remember these permits are pulled right back out of the draw, right? So they're pulled out. And it's a great program. Incentivizes private landowners to manage for the species. But in our recommendations, we have to make sure that we have an objective criteria. And that is where the recommendation comes from for the 3 permits. So it's one thing to say that the 20,000 acres didn't contribute to the habitat, but it did contribute to that final number and how they arrived at 9.
But if you're not losing habitat, then why are you adjusting numbers? Yes, I'm confused. How do you not lose habitat, but you have to change numbers because your acreage doesn't matter?
Well, if we had the habitat from since 1992, and you guys admitted that the 20,000 acres was not elk habitat, why did we have vouchers for the last 30 years?
You know, I would just say that this current recommendation is trying to manage according to what the rule states we do.
Does the DNR factor in the fact, well, let's see how I'm going to put this. Here's bison again. We got bison issues again. We got trouble with the wildlife going on there. So if this doesn't happen and they take the other route and want to get rid of these animals, have depredation, destroy these animals, where do we go there? Where do we win with this one is what I want to ask you. Do you have a method to deal with that?
As far as if they were to pull out of a landowner association, you're saying?
No, I'm saying if they're on his private land, the ranch there, the bison are tearing fences down, destroying the fields, the elk and that. So at what point do you start removing those animals as the division? Where do we win?
Are you talking for bison or elk? Yeah.
I'm asking you, when it comes to that, and you have to deal with these animals, start removing them, and are you going to win letting them have some permits? Or are you going to win going in and killing and removing these animals? That's what I'm asking. Where's your balance? Do you guys factor that in anywhere?
Yeah, I think that's what this program is shooting for, is a balance. We're trying to help incentivize landowners to manage for wildlife and trying to provide a way for them to be compensated for feeding wildlife. We recognize that landowners are an important stakeholder and an important partner. We need landowners to have wildlife, and that's why these programs are here. And so I guess, I don't know if that answers your question, but this is an attempt to, that's what this program is an attempt to establish that partnership.
You guys have like 5,000 head of elk in the Buck Cliffs. If two biggest landowners up there that actually suffer the most damages went into their irrigated fields and decided to start killing elk, we could wipe out 20% of your herd over 2 years and just no problem.
So we're done with public comments. Sorry.
Right.
So we need to, it's okay. It's okay. We just need to either make comments or make a motion. All right. So, Julianne, come on up. Hansmeyer.
I'm Julie Hansmeyer, Campbell Hansmeyer Sheep. I have a ranch north of Cisco, Utah, in Diamond and Cottonwood Canyons, and been there since 1989. And there's a lot of goodwill in the landowner tags, and I think when we're lambing and we turn out ewes and lambs and we're needing all the pasture we got, and there's every night there's 80 or 100 deer in our pastures, and it makes you feel a little better that you are getting some compensation. And we don't have as many elk on our area, but we still have elk bedding down in the summertime. But there's a lot of deer, both from daylight and then at dark, there's just a ton of deer. So I've really appreciated the compensation. It makes life a little easier when we have those big game animals out there. And I've sat on this landowner association board, for quite a few years. And so I don't understand when Mustang Fuels, when they exited, and we lost 6 elk tags, but they didn't gain even one. So that doesn't make any sense to me. And so the objectives are, need to be kind of thought about, I think, by the Division of Wildlife. I spend half the year in Colorado, and Division of Wildlife Resources, excuse me. So I hope this board will recommend to the Division of Wildlife Resources that you maintain the 9 elk tags that not have just been requested, but that we've had in the past, and also the 3 pronghorn antelope permits. And on your chart it says Buck Cliffs North, but it's actually Buck Cliffs North and South, right? Okay, thanks, Brad. Okay.
Comments or motions?
I guess I can make a comment. I kind of agree with it. Leaving the landowner association permits on the Buck Cliffs at 9. It's been that way for a long time, and I think it's worked out well, and at the risk of losing the goodwill of the landowners up there, I don't think it's a risk we want to take. I really don't. Because, I mean, the lawsuits that they, I mean, they're entitled to them. They could bring the lawsuits right now. That's going to cost the division and us as sportsmen and taxpayers a lot of money, and we're going to lose. And besides that, you know, they have a point. I went out and looked a few years ago, and they were growing corn out at Westwater, and the elk moved in there. It was just horrible, the destruction that there was. I think it was 35 or 40 elk at a time going in there. And so, you know, it does cost the landowners money having the elk on there. And not only would I suggest, and maybe I will make a motion, I'll make a motion that we leave the elk permits on the Landowner Association on the Book Cliffs at 9, and also ask the Wildlife Board to look at the possibility of maybe giving them one or two bison permits as well, as part of the solution to the bison problem we have with them leaving and going and creating havoc everywhere.
Question there. It's my understanding you cannot depredate a once-in-a-lifetime animal. Is that correct?
So when you mean what do you mean by depredate?
Can they give these guys a bison tag?
So currently the Landowner Association rule only qualifies for limited entry species, not once-in-a-lifetime.
Even though they don't qualify, that's a question. Is it legally possible to give these guys that are having depredation due to bison a tag?
So we can look at like a depredation hunt. And I think Brad's talked about that earlier. And there, we have tools to address those problems. And we've talked about that quite a bit, I feel like.
I'll second your motion, Kent.
Okay, so we have a motion by Kent Johnson to leave Book Cliffs Landowner Association at 9 elk tags.
What, that is was that, seconded. Is he addressing the antelope too, or just leaving
yes, it? Yes, leave all of it. I forgot.
Okay, so
leave the antelope.
Leave all permits for the Book Cliffs Landowner Association as is. And that was seconded by Jeff Christensen.
I make a comment on the motion.
Sure. I have a comment too, but...
I like the idea where they're going with this. I guess my one concern is we're going against the management plan, and what kind of a can of worms are we opening up? Because if we do this for one association, what's to stop the all the other associations coming and want the same thing?
That was my only
concern. That's my concern.
Too, Mark, is that you're right. You maybe didn't lose quality habitat, but some of these other associations might come forward and say, well, they were reduced by X amount, right? And that's the worry that I see. That was my concern.
I think also. These guys have a particular...
I agree.
Circumstance with the bison added into there,
right,
that most of the others don't, which makes it unique.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Right.
We have most of the private is on the water.
Right.
And the irrigated
ground.
So.
Right. I mean, we're definitely making, hopefully, a special.
Eric brings up a good point, though, and I don't know, you almost need to have a situation by situation. What works for him isn't going to work for all of us. But. I mean, I can feel these guys' pain. I've had 60 head of antelope in a hay patch, and Brad's good about giving me depredation tags, but I can kill two or three, and then they learn to come in there when there's no hunters. And then they wait till them seasons are over, and then they come in, and now I can't do anything until those seasons open back up. I mean, I hate to beat the ag drum, but we're carrying a lot of load on this stuff.
Okay, well, I think it should be acknowledged that this motion is a really special consideration. And so we have it seconded. Can we go ahead and vote on it? So that's just one. Hang on. So we're still...
That's the only change you're recommending, right? Is just to...
That's... Yeah.
That, or everything
can
else
can
is...
Can we add in...
We can add in the rest of the recommendations as submitted.
Okay. Okay. So the motion is to, let's say, do you want me to put that in the front? To accept the management plan Okay, to accept the management plan as proposed by the division with an amendment to leave the Book Cliffs Landowner Association permits as is. Are you good with that? Okay. All in favor?
Hard one.
Eight. And then opposed. So we have Darren Olson opposed.
I guess the hard thing is Mark's the only one here saying, hey, I don't agree with the decision you made. I mean, the other ones, I guess they probably should have showed up. That's the only thing I can say on the issue.
That statement.
Well, it's hard to go against the management plan.
We've already done it tonight.
They've already done it.
Fair enough. Last presentation. We've done really good. Mentor rule amendments by Phil. I'm pretty good.
All right, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Ladies and gentlemen of the RAC, my name is Phil Graham, a license coordinator out of the Salt Lake office. I'll be presenting the proposed changes to the Utah Mentor Hunting Program. The program was introduced back in 2014 by legislative action. All rules and conditions of the program were set in statute. The idea was to provide youth big game hunting opportunities that might not exist elsewhere. The program allows for an immediate family member who is 21 years or older to share their big game permit with a qualifying resident youth. After applying with the DWR, both the mentor and the youth may carry a weapon in the field, but only one animal may be taken, and either one can take the shot. Since the program was started in 2014, we have shared just over 2,400 youth opportunities. This is about 2 weeks out of date, so this has a whole bunch more general season deer and elk that was included in that. And as you can see, the large majority of the permits that are being shared are general season buck deer. So the proposed changes we'd like to make, we actually went back to the legislature earlier this year and asked them to take all of the conditions of the program out of statute and give the authority to the RACs and Wildlife Board to set the program conditions. Everything that we're presenting here tonight is the result of direct feedback from the public and program participants, and these are the few suggestions that we've got from the public that we felt warranted looking at a little bit closer and bringing before you. So the first thing we would like to recommend is to remove the requirement that the mentor be an immediate family member. Right now, the program only allows mother, father, grandfather, grandmother, or legal guardian to take a youth out hunting. It excludes aunts and uncles. It excludes great-grandparents and any other extended family. There's been a lot of requests for neighbors, scout leaders, et cetera. So we would like to recommend removing that and allowing anybody who is 21 years or older to share their permit with a youth. If they are not the legal guardian or parent, then they will have to have written permission from the parent, as well both the parent and the mentor will have to sign an affidavit swearing that they are not receiving or giving any monetary compensation for the youth to go on the hunt. We would like to allow mentors to share other permits, not just big game, and this would open it up to turkey, bear, cougar, sage grouse, sharp-tailed grouse, anything with a kill tag, with two exceptions. That would be swan and sandhill crane. Both of those birds have conflicting federal regulations that would just create a mess that we don't want to get the youth or the mentor into. So we're just going to exclude those two species. Anything else is wide open. There is one other condition that I would like to mention. When bobcat permits are capped under their management plan, so right now, like this year, bobcat permits were unlimited. We sold them for 30 days. Didn't matter how many we sold. People buy six each, but there was no cap on the final number we sell. There is a condition in the management plan that if the harvest gets too high or we start taking too many, then we cap them the next year and we'll only sell X amount. If permits are capped in a given year, then we will allow mentors to share a bobcat permit, but as long as there's unlimited sales for them, then they can't. The youth has just got to go buy their own bobcat tags. And finally, we would like to allow a mentor to identify up to four youths to be mentored at one time. So right now, the biggest complaint that we've had about the program is a youth will draw out a general season tag, and dad will draw out a limited entry tag for the same species, say buck deer, and currently under the rule now, it would require the youth to surrender their general season permit in order to go on the limited entry hunt with the parent's guardian. So the recommendation is we allow them to keep that opportunity. We didn't create this program with the intent of creating opportunities to take opportunities away from them. So we would like to allow the youth to retain their, any other permits they might have, not have to surrender those, but still limit the youth to one authorization per species sex per year. So they could get one bull elk or one cow elk or one buck deer, regardless of any other permits that they might have. And I jumped into my slide too quick. So this would allow the youth to obtain one mentor authorization per hunt year for any species and sex, one buck deer, one bull elk. Thank you.
All right. Do we have any questions from the rack?
So I didn't understand the four youth. Could you explain that one again? What was that?
Yeah, sorry. I kind of glazed through that. Apologize. Right now, the rule requires that a mentor identify one person, one youth to go on a hunt with them. So we're effectively, and this was another big complaint, we're effectively making everybody choose their favorite kid. So if they wanted to take one child out the first weekend, they could do that. They got to come in, apply, pay $10, get the authorization, go out. If they don't harvest and want to take another kid the next weekend, they have to surrender that first authorization, reapply, pay another $10, and then go out the second weekend. So what we're asking to do is allow four youths to be named up front, and they could take all four of them out. You could still only have two weapons and still only one animal taken in the field.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? No comments, right? Okay. Comments and or motions from the RAC?
A motion to accept it as presented.
Okay, so we have Eric Luke. Second. A motion to accept the recommendation as presented, seconded by Helene Taylor. All in favor? And eight. And then one, all opposed? So Darren Olson opposed. We are done. Is that right?
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.